on the download, former Chicago Bear great Otis Wilson, fashion designer and performer Isaac Mizrahi, and the future of surgery with Abbott Labs. Now, here's your host, a man who bought a Ryan Seacrest brand shirt today, Justin Kaufman.
I don't know. It gives me power. It makes me feel good. Ryan Seacrest maybe was in a room saying, this is the kind of shirt I'd wear. It also, and I'm not kidding, one of the things that it boasts is that the shirt will stay whiter for longer. There's no irony in that, Ryan Seacrest? None? But I completed my outfit. I'd been talking about it on the show that I got myself a new suit. Nice blue. It's a little slimmer. This was a slim fit shirt. Look at me. Not that I can fit into it, but that's the style. And I'm very excited to say that I'm going to be debuting the suit on local television Friday night, Chicago Week in Review with Joel Weissman. How fun is that? You know, I was thinking about it. I'm like, well, I actually got the suit and everything because I have a slew of weddings coming up. My cousin's wedding's coming up in October. I got a wedding this weekend. So we need a new suit anyway. And I talked about it. I got the money from my mom. Classic. That's how guys buy suits, even in their 40s. Birthday, Macy's gift card for my birthday. I'm like, no, I'm going to buy a suit now. My olive green suit doesn't work anymore. My forest green pleated baggy suit with my off-white pitted out shirt doesn't work anymore. No. So anyway, I'm gonna bring it out on local television. Very excited for it. I don't know who's on the panel, but I hope it's the old timers like Greising or a McKinney or a Fornick. One of these guys that come in with their standard look, you know, a sport coat, maybe their old tie, and I come in and they're like, who's the nightclub owner with the new suit? And I'll be like, hey, what's up? So we'll do that on Friday. But I'm excited because I think his name was Derek. I can't remember his name, but the guy at Macy's who suited me up, right? Loved him. He gave me this idea, or he told me about how to pick shirts for a suit. And I never knew this because I'm a guy, and a guy goes and finds his size, and I don't even take it out of the package. He's like, no. On a lunch break, go down to Macy's, grab 3 or 4 shirts that are in your size, different brands, go upstairs to the fitting room, try them all on. Pick the one. Do not do it for longer than 30 minutes because at 30 minutes is a threshold in which you start to get crabby and it doesn't matter what decision you make. That's the over. But go in there, be efficient, try them on, trick them off, try them on. I did it today. I've never been so empowered to shop.
Wow.
I feel like I somehow game the system. And of course, the shirt was a $75 shirt that I ended up paying $30 for because that's how department stores work, right? You walk in, you're like, this is expensive. Oh, it's on sale, on sale, on sale, on top of a sale. And they take 15% off just for being in the room. And then you get a shirt that's essentially what it costs at Kohl's. That's essentially
that's how they do it.
That's how they do it, right? So I feel like I've got it together. I got a nice tie. I got a suit. I got the shirt. I'm looking forward to it. But I give kudos to Macy's and to the man in the suit department. I think his name was Derek, but I'm not sure. I'll have to ask my wife, she's got the card, but he gave such great advice.
Yeah, that's good. I don't know how you could do it so quick. It takes me at least an hour to take the pins out of every shirt.
It was tough.
Sneaky pins.
It was tough. But think of, you know what I did? I thought of it to be like a game show. Like the clock was ticking. How many pins? Yeah. He's got the pin, like the American Ninja Warrior, but men's shirts trying to take the pins
times
out.
Times in the bottom corner of the dressing room.
He's got it. Kaufman's got it down. It looks like, oh, he's missed one pin. It's one of the arms is still pinned. He's fudging with it. He can't figure it out. That's how I felt. Welcome to the download tonight. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're with you till 11 o'clock here on 720 WGN. Got an amazing show lined up, an eclectic show, which is apropos for the download. We're going to talk about surgery, nutrition, and why hospitals and doctors continue to tell patients to fast before surgery. This is a big issue. The guidelines have changed. Science and medicine has turned away from the idea that you need to fast, and they actually think that it hurts you to do so. Yet, if you are someone like the millions and millions of people like me, anybody who's had to go in surgery, you're told you have to fast before you come in. It's almost like a wives' tale. It's been debunked, but we still do it. So Abbott Lab's going to be in studio tonight to talk about that. Also coming up, Otis Wilson on life in the NFL, race, Colin Kaepernick, and of course playing for the 85 Bears, and In his new book, he talks about coming to fisticuffs with Mike Dick on a number of occasions. So we'll talk about that. Also coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Isaac Mizrahi. How about that? The fashion icon turned cabaret singer. He's going to be at City Winery this week. And we'll talk with him about his career, fashion, and, of course, song. And, you know, the Cubs are going to clinch tonight. So we'll have that as well. And we'll have Greg Flamm in the swap meet. So we got a lot to do tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. And this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back to the carry out. Stay with us. All right, it's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. All right, here are today's top stories. President Trump unveiled his plans for sweeping tax reform today in Indianapolis. It looks to simplify brackets, give tax cuts for essentially everybody, and with double deductions. It's a plan that was hatched with Republican leaders and seems to have some Democrat support. Hey, I'm all for less taxes. Let's go. I live in Chicago. But as much as I do like this plan, what's not being talked about is how does it affect the bottom line? If you're going to cut taxes for working class, middle class, small business, wealthy, corporations, estates, pets, food, bananas. I mean, I'm no algebra whiz, but I assume that that just means less revenue for the government. And that usually means less money for services like not-for-profits and social service agencies that use federal dollars to help less fortunate. I hope that's not what's happening. I'd love to pay, a couple hundred dollars less a year, but still, for what? Worth watching this as it moves forward, of course. Louisville basketball coach Rick Pitino fired today. The FBI is investigating the program for corruption, essentially criminal recruiting violations. Wow, criminal. Essentially paying families hundreds of thousands of dollars to have their kids play at their school. That's a no-no? This is the same program that was busted a few years back by setting up sex parties for recruits. Say what you will, but at least Pitino's consistent. There are 10 schools that have been accused of these violations. Really, only 10? I mean, how many teams are in the tournament? 64, 65? How many play NCAA Division I basketball? Hundreds? And only 10 are paying or giving them money and favors under the table? Right. Good story. Puerto Rico's on everyone's minds, finally, after Hurricane Maria leveled the U.S. territory. Some critics say that the president hasn't done enough to show support for the people affected. And when he did talk about it on Twitter, instead he talked about how bad the country's debt was to Wall Street and how the Puerto Rican government gave him great reviews for his response. Wow, great reviews. The opening of Broadway review. I love the musical numbers and the quick response to declare disaster and the costumes. Somewhat recommended. It makes you wonder what would happen if a natural disaster hit here in Chicago. The tweet would be like, terrible devastation, fires, flooding in Chicago, a town with so much violence and crime. Terrible, terrible football team. Alderman tried to take my sign down, but loved hitting golf balls at Mar-a-Lago. Policeman told me he could fix Chicago in week. Mayor there needs to toughen up. Hashtag sad. Oh, and ratings are terrible. Hashtag Chicago sad. Trump continues his culture war with the NFL. He doubled down on his stance saying that the NFL should get rid of their players in line or it'll be bad for business. I love that players doing silent protests are more of a threat than the league knowingly hiding bad intel on concussions. So we're saying we don't care about players' knees, we just care about them kneeling. Got it. On it. Also, where are we on the complete corporate takeover of the taking of a knee? This kneeling during the anthem brought to you by Tide. Get your clothes clean. And hashtag unity. Also, Russia now getting in the act? Senator says they're placing tweets and Facebook ads stirring up controversy over the NFL story. Okay, that's where I draw the line. Don't mess with our national game. Two could play at this game, Russia. Watch this. I'm going to right now take out a Facebook ad myself. It's going to put it on Russia Facebook. American blue jeans for sale. Guess, Cavarici, Levi, stonewashed, only $900. Also, your vodka sucks. How about that? In weather, man, last time I followed the weather app at home, right? I mean, I thought today was supposed to be super cold. Everyone's like, oh, yeah, it's fall. I'm like, it wasn't fall. I went outside at noon. I had my fall outfit on, my flannel, my insulated flannel, you know? With my axe. I brought my axe with me downtown and my insulated flannel, my lumberjack look, right out of L.L. Bean. Yeah, it wasn't that cold. Not cool. In sports, tonight's the night for the Cubs, who look to rebound and beat the Cardinals in St. Louis. Right now they're losing in the 6th, 1-0. Last night, wow. Actually, the Cubs win tonight, or the Brewers lose. The Cubs are once again going to make the playoffs, third year in a row. What is this, a Lou Piniella era? Cubs lost last night, but not after making it interesting and having a tying run on second and the ninth, only to watch Contreras strike out on an Ocasio fastball. What's missing here is that the Cardinals are playing for their playoff lives as well, now 3 games back of the Rockies for the last wild card spot. Ready for the final weekend, Brewers, Cards, while the Rockies play the Dodgers. Ooh, could be interesting. Or it'll be wrapped up tomorrow, one of the two. Yeah. Quick update, man, my fantasy baseball championship coming down to the wire. Yep, with only 5 days left, it's all tied up. Although I have Giancarlo Stanton on my team, and he's trying to get 61 home runs, which means he strikes out every time he's up. And what's with the crappy trend of ace pitchers getting shut down because they have nothing else to play for? Bumgarner in San Francisco will not pitch his scheduled start on Friday because, well, he had a good year. What? What about us, Giants? What about me? I cut him from my squad as a lesson to everybody else. When I win this thing, he won't be there for the celebration because he's more interested in preserving his arm than contributing to my fantasy baseball championship. I said good day, Madison. Madison? What kind of name is Madison? The Sox can ruin the Angels' season tonight. They're hanging on by a thread in the AL wild card, but if the Sox win, that's it. The Sox also shut down their ace, Lucas Giolito. He's done for the year. What a year that rookie had, though. He came up in the shaky first start in August. For the most part, turned into the best pitcher the Sox had. A stretch that the Sox were hot. They avoided 100 losses. So serious candidate to be the opening day starter, barring any setbacks in the offseason. So no motorcycle basketball this winter, Mr. Giolito. Cool. Bears getting ready for some primetime football tomorrow against the rival Packers. The Packer quarterback Aaron Rodgers asked the fans at Lambeau to lock arms before the game, which will be tough. I mean, have you ever tried to lock arms around a guy wearing hunting gear? So puffy. So clunky. How do you do it? The Bears are going with Mike Glennon, but you got to believe if he turns in a performance like he did last week against the Steelers, where he throws for 100 yards and barely over 10 yards a pass, this will be the last game as a starter. Yes, the Bears want to give Trubisky some more experience, but experience in watching Glennon command the offense? If he keeps watching this, he's going to think the NFL is a 3-yard swing pass on 3rd and 10. No! No, no, no. Let's not turn him into baby Steve Walsh or mini Shane Matthews. Nobody wants that. You thought the Bears' injuries were bad. The Packers are down to their third-string offensive tackles on both sides. So that could be a factor, but it won't be. I mean, Rodgers will score 4 touchdowns instead of 6. And still no word on whether Josh Sitton's going to play. You know, I didn't think about it, but for whatever reason, if the Cubs can't clinch tonight, they could possibly clinch tomorrow night opposite a Bears-Packers game. That's as close to Chicago sports ecstasy as you can get. Can you imagine? Almost in a way, be like, maybe wait one day. And finally tonight, don't fret. I know the issues of the world right now are pretty heavy, but good news. Scientists have been hard at work on the Solomon Islands, and they did it. They discovered a new species, a giant rat. It can grow to 3 feet long and about 10 pounds, so whenever you're feeling overwhelmed, just think about the people of Solomon Islands. They have the world's issues on their backs, plus rats from your nightmares. So, do you feel better? That's to carry out for September 27, 2017. Hey, we got a new policy, only 2 napkins per customer. You don't need 40 napkins. Don't be a lazy napkin taker. All right, coming up, debunking the myths of surgery. Talk with Abbott Labs about what they're doing to change the rules of nutrition and make us more educated when it comes to getting cut open. Also at 8 o'clock, Otis Wilson joins us at the big table. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Oh, man, I'm so well. Weather's nice.
It's a good fall day, although it's dark. I don't like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, like 6:50, I looked outside and I said to Judy Pilak, who was just about ready to walk out the door, I said, oh, my God, you're going to be driving home in the dark.
Yeah, right.
But I'm with you, though. You know, everyone's like, oh, the cool weather's coming. So, you know, I put on my jeans, I put a long-sleeve shirt.
Right.
I jump outside, I'm like, I'm sweating like a pig.
I was like, wait a second. I had options. I could have gone with a polo.
I could have
short sleeve.
I could have donned the Hawaiian shirt again.
Right. I feel like we're robbing you of Hawaiian shirt time.
Well, I'll bring it back out. Don't you worry. Don't you worry.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with some good news for Chicago Cubs fans. Of course, the Cubs looking to clinch tonight in St. Louis in a three-run homer. Addison Russell? Was that Addison Russell who back, see? And Javi Baez follows up with a single. But the Cubs right now in the top of the seventh inning with a 3-1 lead. Of course, if they win this game, they win the NL Central. So we'll have Kevin Powles at the St. Louis. Is it still Busch Stadium? Is it still Busch Stadium down there? Yeah. And we'll have all of that coming up here on the show. Also tonight, Otis Wilson is here. And we'll also talk with Isaac Mizrahi, the fashion icon, will be on the show a little bit later tonight. Well, now let's talk surgery. It's an inevitable part of our lives, whether we need it to continue living or if we use it to help diagnose a problem or if you elect to fix or mend something on your body. We all know about it, right? But what do scientists know about it? For years, we're told to fast before surgery, to not put food in our bodies for fear of some sort of reaction while under anesthesia. But some doctors actually push back on that notion as the body takes on severe trauma during surgery and needs energy and fuel to help with the healing process. The medical field is looking at that and other long-time procedures and wondering if there needs upgrades. But how do you change the way it's been done for years, especially when patients trust their doctors and develop relationships from generation to generation? For example, Abbott Labs commissioned a survey earlier this year about fasting before going under and found that a staggering number of patients said that their doctors told them that was standard operating procedure. Abbott has been working on making surgery more successful and more efficient and even borrowing procedures from other countries and continents to help make surgery as safe as possible and to push back on some of the myths in medicine. In studio with me tonight, Dr. Hakeem Buzamundo. He's a physician and head of research and development for Abbott's nutrition division. He leads a worldwide team of over 650 physicians and scientists working on nutrition and medicine. Dr. Buzamundo, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me here.
Okay, so let's talk about this because anytime I've been in any situation myself or family members who've gone under the knife, it has been you have to fast 24 hours, 12 hours. Where does, first of all, talk about where fasting comes from, that notion, and then let's talk about debunking that.
Well, Justin, first let me tell you that I'm not surprised by what you're telling me and sharing tonight with our listeners. And before going into the details of when and why have we been doing that for a long time, I'd like to share with you a personal story and tell you why this topic is, I would say, close to my heart. And when I say close to my heart, I mean my words, because 16 years ago, I was diagnosed with a heart condition. And I was told that I need to go for cardiac surgery. Big surprise for me, for my family. So I ended up in the hospital, and I do remember vividly these moments, as you may imagine. And at 7 p.m. after dinner, the nurse told me, now you're not going to eat and drink anything until tomorrow. And I said, okay, I'm good with that. The following day at 6 a.m., the surgeon comes to my room and tells me, you know, we have an issue, an emergency. You won't get in the operating room now. We will get you at 3 p.m. Okay, fine. At the end of the day, I left the operating room at 10 p.m.
Wow.
So this means that this was kind of more than 24 hours, 26
right.
hours of fasting.
I'm sure everyone listening right now who's had surgery feels the same. It's
the
like
same.
That exactly happened to me, right?
And I can tell you that what I do remember is that I was thirsty, I was hungry, and more than anything else, I was anxious. And then following the surgery, I lost 10 pounds within 4 days. And this is where I asked myself, something must be wrong. And this is how I got into this type of topic and got excited and got to the point that I thought we need to do something about it.
Now, the myth is that you fast because you lose your reflux and ability to control your undigested food and you could throw up essentially in surgery. Isn't that the myth of what aspirate? I mean, tell me. I'm simplifying it.
You're not simplifying at all, Justin. You're absolutely right. It's about this risk of shocking, and actually, believe it or not, this goes back to the 19th century, where physicians at that time believed, without any scientific data, that if they would allow their patients to eat or to drink, they would have an issue during the surgery. But again, no scientific data to back up that. And actually, the contrary, the opposite is true. In the mid-90s in Europe, a group started studying this myth, if I may say, mm-hmm. and just considered that if you come up with certain elements related to the surgical procedure, you may reduce complications, you may reduce mortality, you may reduce the length of stay, and you may even reduce the costs. So they run multiple clinical studies, and guess what they found? Yes, we're impacting all these outcomes.
By not having food and water in someone's system, you Correct. Open yourself up for other things, whether it be the lack of healing, infection, anything of those natures. But your body doesn't have fuel to actually start the healing process right after the moment.
You're absolutely correct. And the idea here is really to make people aware of this important topic, which is when you go into a surgical procedure, actually you're preparing yourself as if you would run a marathon. So are you a marathoner yourself, Justin?
Yeah, okay. Sure.
But just imagine for a second that you are. So you would spend 100 calories per mile during your marathon, which basically would make it 2,600 calories mm-hmm. for the entire marathon.
Yeah, that's amazing.
When you go for a surgery, you would burn more than 3,000 calories. So really what you would burn during a marathon. And then the question is, would you fast before a big race? And no. The answer is no. Obviously, I wouldn't do that. But what would you do before? Before you would exercise,
right?
You wouldn't smoke. You would reduce your alcohol consumption. And also, you would make sure that you're getting these nutrients that would help protecting your muscles. Then you would have to go for protein-rich foods, but also for all these nutrients which would help you store all the energy within your muscle.
So dialing back just a bit, Dr. Buzzamundo, I'm interested in why, if it was the 90s and there were studies and clinical trials and the medical community came together and said, fasting is actually hurting us, why does it continue? And I don't put any blame on hospitals or doctors or things, because, even if I went into surgery tomorrow, I'm sure, 7 out of 10, you did the study earlier, 8 out of 10 doctors would say, okay, so this is your last meal. You guys fast from here on out till we have surgery in the morning. They will continue that practice. Why is that happening?
Well, there are multiple reasons for that. The first one, and you alluded to that, it's the myth. So, and it's difficult to just get rid of a myth. This is first thing. When you go to medical school, you are not thought to tell your patient, you need to get a carbohydrate, nutritional rich drink up to 2 hours before the surgery. You're not told that.
No.
And thirdly, although Europe has generated all this data, we didn't have many data generated out of the US. And I believe that now that this practice is expanding in the US, we will see more and more hospitals and health institutions in the US adopting this type of protocol.
The issue here is as well as scheduling and like you talked about, the how long the stay is in the hospital and costs and things of that nature. But are we going to see more of the prescribed surgical procedure being, okay, we're going to schedule this surgery if it's not life-threatening. We're going to schedule it in 3 weeks, 4 weeks. Okay, you're going on a marathon-like training. You need to get on the treadmill. You have to lose this many pounds. You need to tighten your core. You need to essentially act as if you are getting ready for a big, race or, mm-hmm. or athletic event, even though you're having surgery. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that the protocol has to change to say that's part of the prescription?
So unless there's an absolute need to perform a surgical procedure very quickly, ideally, you would always want to give your patients enough time to get prepared. And it could be 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks. But it's important to give them this window where they can prepare themselves physically, mentally, to just go through this stressful experience. Just like marathoners, you mm-hmm. don't prepare a marathon within a week. You need 6
right,
to 12
right.
weeks
Absolutely.
Before doing that.
You're
so it's exactly
under,
the
yeah.
same principle. Yeah,
it's as we think about these things, and one of the head scratchers that comes out of this conversation is, I hope that the medical community, and when we talk about sharing data and the studies, even the studies you did at Abbott, that countries and continents and different parts of the world are sharing this information or finding a way to say that if in Germany they're coming up with new ways to think about colon surgery or heart surgery, that is finding its way to the United States. Is that because I always hear this, and this is all again, it's anecdotal, but I hear of, and you always hear about it in athletes and things like that. They for the basketball player didn't go to the person in Los Angeles. They went to Germany for a different kind of knee surgery. I mean, where are we at a point where can we globalize medicine?
Justin, I must say that, you know, when it comes to living a healthier life, everything should be global. And from that perspective, when we look at these surgical procedures and the nutritional guidelines that are being developed, I must say that the American guidelines are very similar to the European guidelines. And for me, this is all good news because they could look at what has been done elsewhere, develop similar guidelines, and now getting that implemented. And you have very impressive examples here in the U.S. So if you look at the University of Michigan, they did implement a pre-operative nutritional guideline, which included nutrition and exercise. And guess what happened? The patients stayed 2 days less in the hospital, and the costs were reduced by 28%. There's a very interesting study which has been, I guess, published in JAMA in May this year. And this is a study that has been run in more than 20 Kaiser Permanente Center, 15,000 patients, and they did implement the so-called enhanced recovery after surgery protocol, and complications rate was reduced by 30%, mortality was reduced, and costs were reduced. So something is happening in the U.S.,
right.
And I'm glad to share this positive news. Because
from your perch at Abbott, you know, when you're doing research and you're looking into nutrition and medicine, what does it take to get a full-on buy-in from the United States, from all the hospitals, public or otherwise, or university hospitals, to understand that there needs to be different protocols set up for surgical procedures? What's that take? I mean, is that from the government? Is that from awareness? What does it take to change the myth?
It's mainly about awareness. So we need to communicate. And when I say we, it's not only about Abbott. It's about our communities. It's about academia. But, you know, eventually, if government can help also with that, that's great. Because just think from a health cost perspective, this is a huge burden on our health system.
Yeah.
So there's also interest for our government to go down this road.
It's a very interesting topic. Dr. Hakeem Buzamundo is the physician and head of research and development for Abbott's nutrition division, Abbott Labs, up here, right here in Chicago. He leads a worldwide team of 650 physicians and scientists working on nutrition and medicine. We're talking about the myth about surgical procedures, specifically about fasting. Dr. Buzamundo, great to meet you. Thanks for coming in and sharing your work.
Thank you, Justin.
For talking about this issue. All right, watching this Cubs game. Cubs looking good right now. They're in the driver's seat in the seventh inning. They blow it wide open with a 5-1 lead in St. Louis. This means that the Chicago Cubs are two and a half innings away from clinching the NL Central, which used to be a big deal. I don't think we're going to get to the point where Robert Jordan's up on the back of a truck and they're about to tip it in Wrigleyville. That's a classic, right?
I don't know, never underestimate Wrigleyville.
I know, but that's the moment that I in my head, being a kid, the 84 after special, and, you know, he's on the back of a truck,
mm-hmm.
Bob Jordan is from GN, and I think he's up there and he's talking, and they're rocking the truck. And then last year, of course, there was so much going on there. And then I think it was the year, this would have been the Dusty Baker years, when the Cubs blew that game with the Bartman year.
2003.
That's when Wrigleyville jumped the shark. That's when they beat one game against Atlanta and they're burning a car. You know, they're just going crazy. And then I had a couple of old roommates, right? Guys that I knew from back in the day that were troublemakers. I knew them to be troublemakers. I just, you know, just from being around, I know that they're... Everyone knows them, especially living in Chicago for a couple of years. And that's where they were. You know, after game one win against the Atlanta Braves, they're where are you guys going? Oh, we're going down to Wrigleyville. Yeah. Woo! And you're like, yeah, all right. That's not a true Cubs fan. That's just people deciding to mess with stuff.
Yeah.
And so I have a feeling that's more of that plus the Chads and the Justins.
Yeah. You have those, certainly. Yeah. Mucking it up.
Yeah, they'll be down there, too. I mean, good. I mean, and I hope that they don't price gouge. I hope that they have $2 beers that keep the Miller Lights, you know, in the butt, in the tub. I just hope they stock that tub in whatever generic bar on Clark Street. Got great name for a new rap song. Stack that tub, right? I can call 21 Pilots, see if they'll get in to stack that tub. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a sold-out show at the City Winery this Friday. If you have tickets or you're on the wait list, you're one of the lucky ones to see Isaac Mizrahi. Mizrahi's doing a cabaret show called Does This Song Make Me Look Fat? For many, the name Isaac Mizrahi doesn't register when thinking of jazz standards and storytelling. No, we think fashion. The fashion icon and television star has been front and center for years, either wowing us with his collection on the runways of New York or the aisles of your local Target, or on his own cable talk shows or covering celebrities on E! This show is not the first time Mizrahi's taken his talents to the stage. He did a one-man show off-Broadway a few years back, but the show that's coming to Chicago is definitely a new direction and one that he just finished up a sold-out run at Cafe Carlyle on the Upper East Side of New York City. The multi-talented Isaac Mizrahi joins me now on The Download. Mr. Mizrahi, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Hi, thrilled to do it. Thrilled to be here.
I've always been a fan of yours, and I love the television stuff that you've done and also the fashion. Talk about the cabaret side. Where does this idea of getting up on stage and singing and telling stories come from?
Well, I think it's a funny thing, and I don't blame people for thinking of me as a fashion, you know, a figure who's been mostly known as a fashion designer, but my whole creative life started more as a performer. You know, when I was a kid, a tiny kid, like 10 years old, I started doing these female impersonations for, you know, anybody who would listen. And I kind of used to draw these crowds doing Streisand and Judy Garland and Liza Minnelli. And, you know, like, you would never expect that. And, you know, I'll tell you what, like in 1971, right, it wasn't exactly the easiest thing to explain to one's parents right. or one's family. So it wasn't exactly the greatest gift at the time, you know, but it was what I loved doing. And I made puppet shows and I made puppets. And that's how I actually learned to sew, making puppets. But then I went to high school performing arts when I was 13. And I was an actor, you know, and I learned how to do all that stuff. I took lessons and music lessons and piano lessons and dancing lessons. And I transitioned into fashion right after I left high school. I went to Parsons. In high school, I kind of picked up this kind of like fashion fever, you know, and it's something that I really love, you know, and I've done it, I think, very kind of seriously for the past 30 years on different levels.
Yeah, right.
And now it seems like this part of my life, this return to the stage, return to performing and writing material, is very interesting. You know, it's really interesting. It's kind of what I want to spend my time doing, you know.
When you were on top of the world in fashion and doing things where you're introducing us to new clothing and clothing lines, did you always know you were going to return to this part of your life? Always know that once you got past the fashion, that cabaret and creative arts would be calling you back?
You know, I did the fashion part of it. I think I kind of like followed that part of it because it did seem like it would be easier for me to kind of work steadily, you know? Mm-hmm. And I didn't have an unhappy childhood, but it was a childhood that was like kind of religious, and I was sent to yeshiva, and it wasn't very interesting, you know? And so, like, at a young age, I kind of knew that I had to get out at all costs, right? So it seemed like fashion was going to be an easier way for me to kind of make a living and get out and get an apartment and, you know, get a life. And I was right about that, you know? I went to Parsons at the age of you know, 17 or whatever it is you start college, which is basically a trade school. You know, I mean, not only are you learning how to do all that stuff, but also you're kind of like you're inducted, if you will, right into the fashion business. I mean, you know, we had like Calvin Klein as a critic and Donna Karan as a critic and, you know, those designers. And I immediately got a job when I was a junior at Perry Ellis. I got a job. Wow. And it was a great job. It was the job that everybody wanted. And I got it as a junior, you know. And so it was like there was this crazy like impetus. It just moved me right along, you know. But always I knew what my heart was about. I knew it. And I think my best work in fashion is a kind of melding of those things, you know, like knowing how to make clothes, understanding what inventive clothes are, but also like the idea of making them somehow, you know, theatrical. Yeah. And, you know, very, very interesting, almost like fiction. You know, it's almost like writing a story doing a collection.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
And so, like, I never felt like I went away from it, is what I have.
Yeah,
to.
I mean,
I never really felt that way.
It's an expressive art form to make clothing,
yes,
clothing
it is.
Lines of fashion, but also it is performance. Even if you're not the one walking up and down the runway wearing the clothes, there is a performance element, a creative element to being a fashion designer.
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you make, like, 4 huge fashion shows a year that are supposed to be like dramatic spectacles. And I'll tell you, like, when I started, they weren't so dramatic. They weren't these big giant spectacles. I mean, some were, but I kind of took it to this place. I was part of a bunch of people who made fashion shows more about a kind of theatrical happening than people were used to. You know, like in the old days, you went and you saw the clothes and you sat there and you liked them or you didn't like them. And that was it. And in my, you know, when we came about, we sort of made these giant shows. You know, like I used to have thousands of people at my shows and it was very exciting. And eventually, right, like I gotta say this, and I hope I'm not gonna, you know, piss anybody off, but like I will say that there's a certain thing about high fashion that becomes kind of like exclusionary, do you know?
Yeah.
And though I'm very good at making up beautiful, expensive clothes, very precious, precious, new-looking things, you know, it only speaks to a very small bunch of people who can afford it, who can fit into it, you know? And eventually that loses interest to me, do you know? Like, if anything, that whole service idea about, like, trying to democratize it, trying to, like, you know, make it available to everyone, I became a little bored with the kind of exclusive thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like most young designers, I went out of business, and I was so kind of happy about it, you know? I hate to say that, because that does sound a little crazy, but it was really good for me, you know? And when I came back, I started making couture clothes again, but I also did that collection for Target for, I don't know, 7 years or something like that. And that was, I thought, the best thing I ever did, you know? Because it wasn't seen by 4 very skinny, rich women, you know? It was seen by every single woman across the country and men. We did men's clothes, you know? We did pets things. It was such a great thing. We did houseware. It was all great.
It's funny because there's so many different, even celebrities now, I see it with artists and musicians who want to get into the world of high fashion. They want to do everything they can to get to the exclusive part, the high-end fashion area. You rarely hear anyone say, I want to get into fashion to bring the clothes to the masses, to be able to be in aisles at Target. To hear you, Isaac Mizrahi, talking about that, it almost flies in the face of what we know about fashion design.
I know. I'm so sorry. It's just what I feel. You know, it's what I feel. And a lot of times when I see those beautiful things that people make, you know, I long to make those things again. I really do. Don't get me wrong. But a lot of times, and I'm going to say this, I really mean this, a lot of times those clothes are terrible and they're very pretentious. And the only thing that sets them apart from the clothes at Target are the fact that they're really expensive, you know. Just because clothes are expensive doesn't make them good. As a matter of fact, I think most expensive clothes are dreadful. You know, I really mean that.
Yeah.
I do. Some are exquisite. I mean, like, some are so beautiful your eyes fall out, you know, and so new and so fresh and so exciting and worthy of all of the fanfare. But when you consider how many people have fashion shows a season, you totally understand the fatigue that like editors and buyers feel, because there's just so much terrible stuff out there. I mean it. And I say that because I love the subject so much. Do you see? Not saying it's because I'm hypercritical. I'm saying it because it's one of my favorite things, beautiful new clothes, you know?
Yeah.
So I know I sound like I'm full of contradictions, but
No,
life is, right?
No, I love it. I think that fatigue you just mentioned, whether it be designers or buyers, can it also cross over to consumers in the way that they may say, okay, I'm paying all this money for this object and I like it, but there's so much that's coming at me in so many different stores are trying to get my attention. And now I can go online from my couch and flip up my, you know, look on my phone and be able to press buy, 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 buy. Is there going to be a shift in the fashion industry that takes into consideration the consumer habits and the fatigue of consumers when it comes to buying clothes?
Well, I think it's happening. I think, you know, it's been happening. It is happening, right? Like, I think that shopping is a completely, completely different concern than it was 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, right? It doesn't occur in the same way. Like you said, people are at home scrolling on their computers, right? Looking at stuff, ordering stuff, right? That's what's become more fun than going places and standing in those rooms and trying clothes on, right? I mean, you know, there are certain principles about it that never change, right? Like, beautiful fabric is beautiful fabric. Someone who knows how to cut a dress or cut a pair of trousers or do that is going to always do a good job. You know, they're going to do a good job, right? And there have always been terrible, pretentious clothes, you know, and there have always been fabulous, innovative new clothes. And, like, the good designers, I think, have their ears to the ground about these newfound habits of the consumer, you know? They're ready. They're more ready than you'd expect, you know what I mean? And they're already on it. I mean, you know, there's nothing as perceptive as a merchant, right? A merchant perceives what the consumers want.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. I love it. Last question here before we wrap up, and it has to do with your cabaret show and style. Because I was thinking about the cabaret show is one that has been a part of the human experience for decades, for centuries, this idea of jazz standards. And I think about it in parallels with fashion, this idea that everything is cyclical, that trends come back and styles come back. For you to be on stage doing jazz standards like Cole Porter or telling stories in a much more traditional style of theater than what we might see in the new age of theater, there are parallels to the idea that everything that's old becomes new again.
Yes, I agree. But I'll tell you what, I got a review for this show in the New York Times. It was probably like the best review I've ever gotten, right? And the wonderful critic referred to it as alt cabaret. And I'm not exactly sure what that means, except I think he's right. You know, it isn't the same old cabaret. It's a new kind of like expressive form that comes from its roots. You know, there is definitely a big part of it that is about cabaret. And like growing up in New York, being around all of these wonderful cabaret performers, being one myself for a number of years, like, I don't know if you know this, but like for years, for 20 some years, I've been doing gigs in New York, you know, different clubs and, you know, kind of secretly under the wire and not so secretly under, you know, trying to get people to show up at Joe's Pub, you know, or wherever it was I was performing for years, right? But what I will say is that, like, consider my best friend for 10 years was Sandra Bernhard. You know, she's a great cabaret performer. My idol was Eartha Kitt and Elaine Stritch and Bobby Short. I mean, I idolized those people, and I went regularly to see them. And what they did was so superb and classic, you know. And what I'm doing, I'm trying to be superb and classic myself, you know. In the process, some of it is coming out, like, very wacky, you know. And by the way, if you're listening to this and you're coming to the show, you know, you're going to see that it's a very louche kind of a show. Like, there are no holds barred. I mean, like, I talk about a lot of things that you might not expect me, this very gentlemanly fashion designer, to be talking about, you know, like drugs and sex, and you'll see, you know. So where it is, yes, classical cabaret, hoping that it's being pulled in this direction now, you know, this new direction.
Well, leave it up to Isaac Mizrahi to bring something new to the world of cabaret. The show is called Does This Song Make Me Look Fat? It's at the City Winery this Friday night. It's sold out, but there is a wait list, so go check it out. Isaac Mizrahi, I can't thank you enough for taking some time out to talk to us now. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm thrilled. Thank you. Thank you.
Make Sundays your official night to tour the city, watch Chicago's best at 10 p.m., and stick around for the latest in shopping, entertainment, and events on See Chicago at 10:30 p.m. on WGN-TV. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We will check in with Kevin Powell, who is at Busch Stadium in St. Louis, as the Chicago Cubs have a lead right now in the eighth inning. They are pretty much have this game in hand, but it starts to get a little hairy as the Cardinals in the bottom of the eighth with two out have been able to put two runners on to at least amp up the pressure a little bit. The Cubs still in the lead with a 5-1 lead right now in St. Louis. So, but that being said, still a long way to go, or at least a short way to go. I don't know. It feels like that may be the case. But, of course, when that happens and the Cubs clinch tonight, we will have reports from Busch Stadium, we'll have reports from Wrigleyville. We'll also have Mark Harmon will be in studio with me tonight. So we got a lot going on. I know I had promoted Otis Wilson tonight, and I'm not sure. We'll see if we get to him or not. We may have to reschedule and put him on a different time. Also, Greg Flamm in the swap meet as well, rescheduled tonight. We'll get back to him tomorrow. That just gives you more time to go into your attic, your garage, other places, and get yourself prepared. If you're like me, every week that comes on, right when it comes on, I go, oh, darn it. I know I was going to go check out what I had in that box. Next time. So now I'm giving you a week. I'm giving you a week off. The next time is now, right? And tonight also we want to hear from you and your memories of watching the Cubs clinch in 84, 89. What would it be, 07, 06, 07, those guys? Were those the Lou Piniella years,
my favorite. 07, 08,
the DeRosa years, as I say.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the last 2 years. But I find this to be almost like a holiday when you talk about traditions and memories, history. When a Chicago baseball team clinches their division, it's so rare. Yet we live in times where it's fruitful.
Yeah, like you
the harvest is fruitful.
Like you mentioned yesterday about, you know, you still picture that, you know, Rick Sutcliffe pitching that one game was against the Pirates.
Yeah, it's the Pirates.
And then in 89, who was it, Sutcliffe again? I don't remember.
I don't remember
that
one.
But you remember those highlights,
yeah,
like Jim Fry running out, putting his hat like in his jacket. Do we remember do we not care about that anymore? Like, what happens when?
Well, I wonder, because other teams have clinched. Like, if you look at the New York Yankees, who are a wild card team this year, they clinched. They're in. I'm not even sure beyond, you know, putting some tarps over their lockers if the media even cared, because they do it every year. So teams that have been there before, it becomes less and less special.
But think about this, guys. Next year, potentially, this could be like the Golden Corral buffet for baseball fans.
That's right.
Cubs and White Sox.
Yeah, the White Sox.
Right?
The White Sox right now are winning on the and they get a win tonight. I have to say, they single-handedly, by giving the Astros fits in the last two series they played, may have kept the Astros from winning home field throughout the AL. Tonight, even though there's very little opportunity for the Angels to catch the Twins, they're five games back with five to play. There's no room for error, and it's actually working for them tonight because Cleveland is beating up on the Twins. But it's the White Sox who are beating the Angels. If the Angels lose, they're out of it. Yeah, there's something to be said. The Lopez is pitching great, shutting them out four innings through. You got Lopez and Giolito, who really showed something at the end of the year for the White Sox. Helped them avoid 100 losses.
I just feel bad for you and your fantasy team.
Yeah, it's going to be a couple of really stressful days. That's the only problem. I am a two-time champ. I'm a defending champion. And the problem right now is that my strategy, which is to collect as many aces throughout the year, that's my strategy. I don't really care about hitting. I care about pitching. And so I make all these trades to get the best and the brightest. Corey Kluber's, Madison Bumgarner's, Jacob DeGrom's, David Price's, Felix Hernandez. Like, that's a pretty staunch. I mean, that's a hefty rotation for a fantasy team. And what's happening is they're all being like, oh, he's done for the year. What a great year. Oh, you know what? He doesn't hit the pitcher's last pitch. It was great. Give a minor leaguer a chance. I'm like, no! Bumgarner, get your butt in there. and pitch that meaningless game on Saturday, right? Get one more for us. Give us a complete game shutout for the fans. For me. All right, we'll come back and we'll catch up with Kevin Powell, who's at Busch Stadium watching the Cubs, who now the Cardinals have loaded it up with Carl Edwards Jr. on the mound. So we'll take a break. We'll get an update with Rob's news, and then we'll get Kevin on the phone, and we'll get ready for what could be coming up here this hour. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Yes, this is a download here, 720 WGN, the Chicago Cubs. One half a frame away from clinching the NL Central. Kevin Powell is down at Busch Stadium where the plastic is being put on the visitors' locker room right now. The Cubs with a 5-1 lead going into the bottom of the ninth inning. Kevin, what's the atmosphere like there? I mean, obviously they're on the road. There's a lot of St. Louis fans there. They're still sort of in the playoff hunt, but a lot of fans travel.
Oh, yeah, and especially tonight when everybody knew this could be the clincher. Tonight and last night, there's a ton of Cubby blue sprinkled throughout the ultra-red Busch Stadium here. So a ton of Cub fans. I'm sure they're going to be sticking around, maybe get sprayed with some champagne if they're able to hang on to this thing. But, the Cubs offense really wasn't able to figure out Michael Wacha until the seventh inning, and then they put up five runs or so in that inning and six hits, something like that. So this is what we saw them do last year. You know, third, fourth time around seeing a pitcher, that's when this offense erupts. And, you know, going forward, I think teams with the best bullpens are going to have a shot with this team, because when this lineup sees a pitcher three or four times around in one game, it's dangerous. They're proving it's just as potent as it was last year at this time.
Well, one of the great positive storylines, Addison Russell, who has had an up and down, mostly down season this year, comes through with the big home run tonight. Addison Russell seems to be getting back into the groove right in time for the playoffs.
Yeah, he had so many injuries. And I think, you know, look, it's going to be great if they hang on here. The cherry on top of it all is that they're going to be celebrating in front of the Cardinals. First time they'll win a title in St. Louis since 1938. So, you know, the other part of it, the bigger picture, is that the Cubs are going to get to rest. And they need it. Everybody's a little banged up right now at this time of the year. So Joe Maddon talked about it. Chris Bryant admitted before the game, he said he would love to, you know, get a few days off, get some rest, and get, you know, pick their feet up a little bit before the postseason. So this would be huge to get this out of the way. It doesn't hurt that it's in enemy territory.
Right. The other part of this story, too, is that this, if it does stay the same here in the ninth inning with the Cubs leading 5-1, the St. Louis Cardinals, this is a huge, huge problem for them as they are inches away from being eliminated in wild card scenario.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and we've seen it the past few years now, right? Like 2 years ago, the Cubs beat the Cardinals in the postseason. Last year, the Cubs win it all. And now this year, they're probably clinched on Cardinals territory. The NL Central looks a whole lot different than a few years ago when everybody was looking up to the Cardinals. It's changed, and I think it changed last year once the Cubs put the exclamation point on it and won the World Series. But especially now, like these are the sorts of moments that you felt like the Cubs dealt with for years. You know, teams winning on their home field, and the Cubs chasing and looking up to other teams. But it's changed now. It's flipped. Everyone is looking up to the Chicago Cubs right now.
Well, Wade Davis is on the mound as he gets ready to mow down the St. Louis Cardinals in the bottom of the ninth to take this 5-1 victory to final. Kevin, what about the fans there? I mean, I would assume with the 4-run lead that you might see some Cardinal fans heading for the exits they don't want to see as they do a sort of wide-angle shot at Busch Stadium right now. Yeah. There's a lot of empty seats as Cardinal fans don't want to be a part of this.
Yeah, well, I'm sort of in the tunnel near the clubhouse right now, and there's a, kind of a lounge area with TVs, and fans can kind of hang out there, drink their beers, relax. And right when I got down here, I heard a couple – Cardinals fans, man, I don't want to see them celebrate on our field, and that's probably going to happen here if they can hang on. So a few of them were heading out, but they were, I think, clinging on to any hope that one, they can avoid the seeing the Cubs celebrate at Busch Stadium, and two, their playoff hopes, which were already very slim heading into this game. But man, the Cubs have a shot here to be popping champagne in St. Louis and pretty much eliminating the Cardinals out of the playoff picture. Yeah.
You know, Kev, when I think about it and I look at this, I mean, you've been a part of the obviously the Cubs in the last 3 years have shown themselves to know how to celebrate. what do we expect? I mean, they're on the visiting field, so they're going to possibly be in a position where, you know, they make a lap for the fans that are there at Busch Stadium. Do they go right to the locker room? What do they do?
Yeah, I was told they're going to do something sort of quick on the field and then head into the locker room. I think they're going to be classy about this whole thing and not really rub it into the face of Cardinals fans. They'll spend a little time out in the field, but I think much of the rowdy celebration will likely be going on in the clubhouse, and that's why all the media around me right now are putting their raincoats on or champagne coats. At this time of the year, we call them champagne coats, I guess. But everyone's kind of gearing up for that. And, I think you're going to see some pictures and some things on the field. But, plenty of craziness happening in the Cubs clubhouse. It should be fun.
Do the Cubs, the players and the coaches, do they take it seriously that they won this division? I mean, is this a serious celebration? Or are they at the point where they're like, hey, we don't celebrate till we get to the second, third round of the playoffs?
Yeah. Joe Madden was asked about that, and he shot that down immediately. And I think that's something you have to appreciate about the Cubs, and Theo Epstein has said this. He says, winning is sacred, and if you got a shot to win, like a legitimate shot, you go for it. And that's what the Cubs did this year. I mean, don't forget, they're going for it. They traded all their prospects this year to get Jose Quintana to shore up the catcher spot with Avila and Justin Wilson, who struggled again today. That's a whole nother story, but they went all in on this after winning a World Series. A lot of teams can pull off the pedal a little bit and make sure you don't spend, give away too much of your farm system. But if you're in a position to, A, get back to the postseason, win your division, and fight for another World Series, you go for it. And Joe Madden talked about that. You know, he says once you become complacent with winning, no matter what it may be, then you're in trouble. So I think you're going to see a full-blown celebration here tonight. I don't think you're going to see anybody holding back. I'm serious. I think they understand the magnitude of this. I think they're going to be a little bit ramped up. It's in St. Louis. I think they're going to, enjoy that. But, they're not going to, downplay the fact that they won the division is for some reason not big anymore because they're the reigning champs. It means something. It definitely means something.
You know, one thing we pointed out here on the download and just in general in Chicago media is that the Cubs had a tough road of it. They had four games in Milwaukee, the four games set here at Busch Stadium. They're finishing on the road. But as it turns out, they took care of business. I mean, they essentially pushed the Brewers right out of the division race. And here with the Cardinals, I mean, this is only game three of the series, but they look to be taking two of three already and clinching a division. So, again, road warriors in the way that they seem to play well away from Wrigley Field.
Yeah, and if you look over the past few years under Joe Madden, the Cubs have won something close to like 70% of their games in August and September. I think you can look at a couple things there. I think Joe Madden is a really good manager, despite what some of you Cub fans may still, Game 7, no matter what happens, even though they won the World Series, some Cub fans are still bitter about the way Joe Madden handled it. He's a really good manager, and he understands the importance of patience and rest and sort of the rhythm of the season. He's been around for a long time. And, he keeps his guys fresh, especially now this season. They weren't going to push it too hard. They were under 500. I mean, don't forget that. They were under 500 going into the All-Star break, and they've absolutely turned it on in the second half, especially as of late, winning, 11 of 14, 11 of 13, something like that. So they know when to put the pedal to the metal at the right time. And, I think that's credit, obviously, to the players, but, and the depth they have. I think that's something we can't talk enough about. It's so much depth and the versatility from guys like Ben Zobrist to Ian Happ, to guys that can play multiple positions. That allows Joe Madden, before the past two seasons, we're like, how are they going to get all this talent on the field? Well, you don't have to have it all on the field at the same time. You can rotate these guys and keep guys fresh and play matchups and things like that. So that's Theo and Jed building this roster, and that's Joe Madden managing it and doing a phenomenal job with it.
Well, right now the Cubs have two outs. Wade Davis mowing through. There's a, they've had the great catch by Jason Hayward down the right field line, and right now an 0-2 count.
Speaking of Wade Davis, sorry to interrupt
you. No, please.
You can make an argument. He's the MVP of the year. Because what would this bullpen be? Where would this team be if Davis wasn't on this on this roster. He's been an absolute rock. He didn't blow a save until last weekend in Milwaukee. Other than that, he's been lights out. This biggest weakness on the Cubs right now is that bullpen. There's some definite question marks there, but you know you can go to Wade Davis, and I'm really interested to see how Madden's going to use him in the postseason. Does he use him like one of those fire extinguisher guys where you bring him in important situations, no matter what the case, which we saw throughout the entire league last postseason. Right,
right? You bring him in the seventh inning, right.
Yeah, you bring your best reliever in the most important situation. I'm really interested to see if Madden implements that with Davis, although we haven't really seen it in the regular season. He's a rock. I mean, he has been their most consistent arm out of that bullpen. And imagine if Wade Davis wasn't on this roster.
Right, if they had trouble on the back end, right.
The Davis for Soler straight-up trade, never forget it. That may be the robbery of the season.
All right, Kev, 2-2 count here. Wade Davis pitching to DeJong, who's up to bat right now.
Paul DeJong. He's an Illinois State Redbird. I might as well plug that really quick.
He was. There you go, Illinois State. DeJong up to bat right now. 2-2 count, foul ball. So the bottom of the ninth inning right now, the Cubs with a 5-1 lead over the Cardinals. You know, it is interesting because...
Yeah, you can see Cub fans now. Sorry again, Justin. They're all lingering over the dugout. They're ready to explode. So, obviously, winning is not getting old for Cub fans, although this might be new to pretty much everybody, this sort of dominance over a couple years stretch. It's not getting old.
Yep, they're chanting. They're chanting, "Let's go Cubs" right now at Busch Stadium. They're holding up babies. Everyone's moving down to get as close to the field as possible. It's Wade Davis is a chance to finish out a 1-2-3 ninth inning right here. The Chicago Cubs with a 5-1 lead. The fly ball.
Martin will not get it.
Oh. So the Cardinals almost at it there, but the Cardinals, DeJong, your Illinois State Redbird, comes up with a double in the ninth inning. I blame this on you, Kevin.
Yeah, well, that's what Redbirds do. We can continue to compete out there. I apologize to Cub fans out there, but Redbirds keep battling, whether it's an Illinois State Redbird or a Cardinals. So, this is a ton of anticipation. They've been looking forward. They know what they did. And Jason Hayward talked about this before the game, that, or even last night after the loss, was, okay, we lost. We wanted to get this out of the way as soon as possible. But, you know, they're proud of the fact that they built – a little cushion in this division. You know, you got to give them credit for that.
They did.
And allow them to pull this off. And the Cubs, for the first time in over 100 years, are headed to the postseason for three consecutive
seasons. Let the celebration begin!
There it is, the Chicago Cubs.
There
you go. Kevin Powell in the building in Busch Stadium as the Cubs go crazy. They win 5-1, the celebration on the diamond right now. And the Cubs clinched the NL Central for the second time in some consecutive years. Kevin, what's the atmosphere? What are you feeling there?
Yeah, well, we're underneath getting ready to head into the clubhouse.
You can hear the thunder.
Absorb this celebration, but we can absolutely hear the Cubs fans roaring above us. The seats are ahead of us here. We're like in the bowels of Busch Stadium, but it is loud. It's going to be wild. I expect Cub fans to be hanging out for a while celebrating this one, Justin. Not sure if you heard, but this is the first time since 1906, 07, and 08 the Cubs are headed to the postseason for three straight consecutive seasons.
Unbelievable.
Haven't seen that in over 100 years. First time they're clinching a title of any sort in St. Louis since 1938. So, Justin, I'll check in with you later.
Sounds good. We're about to head in
and absorb this.
Good luck. We'll check in later. Kevin Powell at Busch Stadium getting ready to be doused with champagne as the Chicago Cubs. Look at what they did. They have now been three straight playoff appearances. The first that's happened since, 1906, 1907, and 1908. They win tonight, beating the Cardinals 5-1 at Busch Stadium in St. Louis. Right now, this would be on the 158th game of the season. Right now, the Cubs at 89-69. A much deserved celebration on the field for the Chicago Cubs. As Kevin pointed out, close to 500 at the All-Star break. Think about that. I mean, just to give you those numbers of 89-69, to be 20 games up over 500 right now, it tells you how much success they've had in the second half of the season. We got a big show lined up tonight to celebrate the NL Central champion Chicago Cubs. 312-981-7200. You like the chance of this team? You like what happened in the second half this season? Also, your memories of watching the Cubs clinch in the past. We'd like to hear it all tonight. 312-981-7200. Mark Carman's coming in studio. Kev Powell's at Busch Stadium. And we've got Violetta Padromedic out in Wrigleyville. So we've got a lot going on tonight as the Cubs clinch the NL Central. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll get the festivities started. Stay with us.
Go, go, go. Chicago Cubs. Win, win, win that game. Go, go, go. Chicago Cubs.
2017 NL Central champion Chicago Cubs. They clinch tonight in St. Louis at Busch Stadium with a 5-1 win. Mark Carman, WGN Sports, in studio tonight. Join us for the next hour to talk about this. I mean, it's pretty amazing to think about the Chicago Cubs 3 years in a row going to the playoffs. The first, I mean, over 100 years since that's happened.
I first of all, Justin, I think we should make this about me and you, because last year at this time, we were doing pregame shows, we were doing hour-long specials.
I love it.
And here we are.
Here we are, we're back.
Back again, the Cubbies, with two straight divisions, three straight playoff appearances, and the opportunity to go back-to-back with a legit shot at it. Up and down roller coaster, the whole thing, but here they are, right?
Here they are, and we'll talk about what to expect from the playoffs, also what got us here. I mean, to think about the Cubs being almost 500 and a couple games back at the All-Star break, and to a team that's now 89-69, 20 games over 500. What a second half. Almost, I mean, if you think about the Cubs lore, it fits in as one of the better second halves in Cubs history.
No question. And Joe Maddon, give him credit, his teams have always gotten better as the season goes along, and that was part of the reason why when they were struggling and under 500 and chasing the Brewers, hey, Maddon's teams always seem to play well in September, and it started a little earlier than that. But true to form, they did.
Yeah.
And, hey, we'll see what happens.
We got a lot to talk about. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to get involved in the conversation tonight as we break down the Cubs clinching the NL Central, the 2017 champs. They, of course, will go to the playoffs and play the Washington Nationals in the first round next week.
No problem.
No problem. We'll talk about that as well. Kevin Powell's at Busch Stadium getting ready to be doused with champagne. Violetta Padromedic's up in Wrigleyville for any festivities that might spill out of the bars. We got a lot to do tonight here as we celebrate the Cubs. Stay with us. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. All right. Mark Carman's here. We get ready to go as we celebrate the Cubs, as the images on Comcast right now show them spraying champagne all over each other. It's a good look.
One of the great traditions.
It
one
really
of the great
is.
American baseball, societal, it's life.
We were just talking about it. All the other major sports, there isn't this tradition when just to get into the playoffs. Like if you think baseball, basketball, hockey. They'll get into the playoffs, and after they win a series, they'll celebrate. But there's not this tradition of going crazy about getting into the playoffs. It has to do with the season being
so
long.
16 of 30 hockey teams make it to the playoffs.
Yeah, that might be part of it.
I mean, come on.
That could be part of it.
162 games. You got to celebrate.
You got to celebrate. It's a long season. Today, yes, the Chicago Cubs beat the St. Louis Cardinals tonight at Busch Stadium to clinch the NL Central, the 2017 NL Central champs. They have the record of 89-69. This was the 158th game of the season. Last year, they did it. We had 17 games left in the season. It was a little bit easier, less stressful. But the Chicago Cubs get it done. They are the champs in the NL Central. They'll play the Washington Nationals next week.
I mean, give them credit. You had Jake Arrieta having his injury. John Lester was on the disabled list. Kyle Hendricks missed a ton of time. It has been been a lot of injuries. Chris Bryant missed a little bit of time with the finger in and out of the lineup.
Addison Russell,
and they're here. So I think it's a huge question right now. As you look forward, well, who's going to start Game One? Joe Maddon. And I don't know what the answer is. I don't think, last night Jake Arrieta did not look good, three innings. and he's not going to be 100%. So that's not good. I think it might be Kyle Hendricks, but you know, and it's a huge decision too, who starts game one, because if it does go to five, that's your starter.
That's your starter, right?
So I mean, he was
And there's also a bunch of roster stuff that they have to decide, including John Lackey. What do you do with him when they already kind of have their starters set up for the playoffs? Mark Carmen in studio, WGN Radio Sports. The Cubs, of course, clinched the division tonight, so we're talking Cubs. 312-981-7200. We've got great stuff tonight. Kevin Powell's in the locker room with the Cubs at Busch Stadium. Violetta Podrometic is in Wrigleyville right now as the festivities begin. Mark Carmen, of course, in studio. This Cubs team, again, as we reiterate, they had a tough first half of the season, but their second half has been historic. I mean, in the way that they turned the season around, and even as we talked about, the road trip that they're on right now, with four games in Milwaukee, four games in St. Louis, they made it look like cake.
No doubt. It was, oh my God, they got to go to Milwaukee and play the Brewers four times, and then they got to go to St. Louis. Oh, it could go so awry. And then, really, they could have swept the Brewers. Of course, there were a lot of close games. Milwaukee could have won them, too. But three out of four, and now down to St. Louis, could have won last night, too. And it's just showing the separation, right? And then, you know, you go back, Justin, you're talking about, you know, the second half. They start the second half at 44-45.
Wow.
And they had that crazy game with Baltimore where they were up 8-1 or 8-0. The Orioles come all the way back to tie it. Like, first you're at 8-0. I'm like, okay, it's the second half of the season. Great.
There we go.
And then they blow it like, oh, my God, it's the same team. And then Addison Russell hits a home run, and they end up winning the game 9-8. And then they just go on a run of, what, six in a row at that point, and took two or three from the Cardinals after that. And you know, came home and played the White Sox, beat them 3 out of 4, went to Milwaukee, took 2 out of 3, and from there, it's just over. I mean, they've been rolling ever since. Got back in the first place.
What has been, I mean, you talked about injuries, but what has been the recipe for them to have such an unbelievable second half?
I give a ton of credit to their offense. There was so much, and I was a big believer in, you need Dexter Fowler. That guy's got to be at the top of your lineup. Well, Dexter Fowler was just on the field in St. Louis watching the Cubs celebrate. Not that they couldn't use him, but I think you got to give a ton of credit to John Jay, who's been huge when he's gotten a chance to lead off, which has been a lot, and I think he'll get to do it in the playoffs too. Albert Amora, whenever he was given a chance.
He had a great second half.
Great, you know, batting against left-handers and playing center field. He was fantastic. Ben Zobrist had a better second half. Give credit to Schwarber, too. I mean, he was brutal in the first half. Got sent down, comes back up. His numbers since he came back from AAA have been very respectable. Borderline, I mean, for a guy who's had a terrible season, he's still going to hit close to 30 home runs. That's not the worst year in the history of baseball.
Well, I mean, that brings up a great point, that there's been so much made of the Los Angeles Dodgers, even the Arizona Diamondbacks in the NL, been a lot made on the AL side with Cleveland Indians and their streak, and even the Houston Astros. But because the Cubs started so slow and they were at 500 and everyone was scratching their heads, they haven't had the headlines. But this second half is on par with what you see from some of the best teams that we're talking about. They do have a momentum going into this playoff.
No question. And just, you know, looking at the quotes coming out of St. Louis, Anthony was like, hey, never gets old. And, you know, we're excited about going in. We got a great chance. And they do. And Rizzo, I got to tell you, I mean, this guy, 274 the batting average, is on-base percentage up at 400. He's got 32 homers, 109 RBIs. He's a phenomenal first baseman. He's a great leader. And
it's clutch.
He's clutch. He's learned how to hit with two strikes. He was a guy who was here when they were absolutely awful and wanted to fight the entire Cincinnati Reds dugout when they were winning 68 games. That's a guy. I mean, I love KB and the MVP and all that.
You put Anthony Rizzo as the heart and soul of this team?
Rizzo's the heart and soul to me. And, you know, I love KB. And Javi Baez, too. Give that guy a ton of credit. Russell goes out. Hey, man, yeah, you're not moving around the diamond or playing second base anymore. You're playing shortstop every single day. You got to lock it down. And by the way, we could use some clutch performances at the plate as well. And he did all of it.
He had another reason where the Cubs had a great second half. Javi Baez moving the shortstop, not just on the defensive side, who was showing up on SportsCenter plays in the night every night. But yeah, you're right. I mean, and Wilson Contreras as well had a huge, I mean, he had the DL stint, of course, but before that and even after, making big plays.
Right. And, becoming, well, you know, that's you think about Contreras, then you go to Miguel Montero and his moment where he freaks out because eight guys stole bases on him, and what am I going to do? Jake Arrieta is the slowest guy in the history in the world to the plate. Don't put it all on me. They cut him, and Contreras actually took off from there because he felt like, okay, I'm the senior guy now, and I got to do it, and he did.
312-981-7200. Mark Harmon in studio. All right, we'll check in with Violetta Podramedic, who's up in Wrigleyville. Also, Kev Powell, who's in the locker room, and more with Mark Harmon here in studio. Again, 312-981-7200. If you'd like to talk about your memories, what you think of the 2017 Chicago Cubs, or just clinch night. And where were you in 1984?
And I'm wondering, like, is this like old hat now? Are people just not that excited? Because, I mean, I was, you know, across the street having dinner at Howell's and Hood waiting to come in here. And I'm like, hey, can you put the sound on? Because, you know, they're about to clinch the division and World Series maybe back-to-back. Yeah, nothing.
Nothing.
And there was like three people in there.
Yeah, well, they're close.
Where's the excitement?
Where's the excitement, Chicago? The Chicago Cubs. I mean, maybe it is a little bit. We'll talk about that. The fatigue. Not fatigue's not the right word, but maybe just we've been here before, and let's celebrate when we get closer to a World Series. But, again, any lifelong Chicago sports fan knows how impressive it is that the Chicago Cubs have gone back-to-back-to-back in the playoffs. Mark Carman in studio, Justin Kaufman here, 312-981-7200. Stay with us. The Chicago Cubs clinched the NL Central. What a night. I love it. I don't see it as old hat. I think it's a great thing, and I love that the Chicago Cubs have once again done it back-to-back-to-back, the first time since 1906 to 1908. How crazy is that? Mark Carman in studio. It is hard to believe, and it feels like with this team, even after winning the World Series, they continue to sort of break down the old myth that is the lovable loser myth.
Teams that win the World Series, generally next year, they don't win the division. And the Cubs were like, we're winning that division. And by the way, I mean, I think it's part two of the three-peat, Justin. Why stop at one? You've got all these youthful fellows. They're in their prime. The pitching's a little wonky, sure, but why not part two of the three-peat? There's no reason to stop right now.
Well, let's find out. I mean, we kind of talk about the idea that is this old hat or are people getting excited? Let's go to Wrigleyville. Violetta Podramedic standing by. She is at Wrigley Field right now. Are people flocking to like pilgrimage to Wrigley Field to celebrate the clinch tonight, Violetta?
I don't know if it was a pilgrimage, but there were about 50 to 60 people right by the marquee at Clark and Addison, and I don't think they're getting bored of winning and celebrating, honking, champagne popping. You can hear people here still singing and screaming, "Go Cubs, go!" And it was still a lot of fun. I don't think they're not done winning.
They're not done winning. All right, Violetta, you are a veteran now of Wrigleyville celebrations. You were you were out there all last year for the playoffs. Do you feel a sense that Clark Street's going to start to fill up, that people are coming out, that this is a celebratory night?
Yeah, definitely, and especially because they're still riding the high from being World Series champs. And they said, I interviewed some people earlier, we'll have that audio pulled up later, but they said that, last year was incredible, and they're looking to do it all over again.
What are you looking forward to? I mean, as you get ready to cover the partying that's going to happen in Wrigleyville, are you excited about that assignment again, or you wish that you would get reassigned to something else?
No, I love it. I love it, but it's a little bit more nerve-wracking. People are saying now they have to defend it, so it's a little bit more than last year. Last year, history was not on our side, but now they have to defend their title, and it's going to be a little bit more work.
Violetta, last year, right, the Cubs have to defend their title, and I think you have to defend your position as the partying reporting Cubs reporter, if that works. Last year, I think you rode on a bicycle. You did other other type of things. What do you have in mind this year? I think you should at least ride one of the police horses around the stadium, something.
Right, yeah, I might be getting too old for this. Are you telling me I'm getting too old for cover this?
No, I think you need to reinvent yourself, though, with a new gig, something more exciting.
Champagne showers on the street, or is that illegal?
It is Wrigleyville. I don't think anything's illegal up there. Let me ask this. I just realized that this is the first year with the new build out of Wrigley Field. They got the grass there. I mean, are there more people congregating in that area? I'm always thinking they're just going to the corner and just walking in the street, but I guess they don't have to now.
No, definitely. I'm not sure if the store was open earlier, but I did see people with a lot of Cubs bags. I don't know if they were playing the game on the big screen, because there is a big screen right there in the park overseeing the grass. That would be probably a great place for people to congregate. But I think the marquee with the Fly the W hashtag is pretty much the selfie and the picture that everyone wants to get. But they do have, obviously, a lot more space now with the park at Wrigley.
Yeah, that'll change the dynamic when it comes to the postseason in Wrigleyville. Violetta Podramatic covering the celebration in Wrigleyville tonight. It's the Cubs clinch. Violetta, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
All right, there you go. She did a great job last year, and she was top-notch in covering the bedlam that is Wrigleyville and Clark Street in that area. Texts are coming in at this point. And it's funny because the texts are not necessarily about how great this experience is or reflecting on the tradition and all the great things that have happened in Cubdom. No, they're talking about how the Cubs don't have what it takes to beat the Nationals. About two in a row that say the Nationals are going to sweep these guys out.
All right, everybody settle down. Let's not. When has Dusty Baker ever beaten a team like the Chicago Cubs? Listen, this is it's going to be tough. You got Max Scherzer. You got Steven Strasburg at the top of that rotation. Those, you know, some hard-throwing righties, which it's not going to be easy. I get it. Gio Gonzalez is no slouch, too, from the left side, too. That being said, I got full confidence.
None of those pitchers scare me. Scherzer's had a really weird year. He's kind of their Arrieta, where the thought was he was supposed to be more of a Clayton Kershaw, and instead you've seen a lot where 3, 4, 5 innings where he's given up 6, 7 runs. He had a great stretch there in the season, but I truly believe that the Cubs could get to a guy like Max Scherzer.
I'll give you one stat that does frighten me. 197 and a third innings, less than one hit per inning is a good stat. He's given up 125 hits in 197 innings. Wow. That being said, he hasn't seen Chris Bryant step into the dish, baby. He hasn't seen an Anthony Rizzo in playoff baseball. He doesn't know what Wilson Contreras is going to bring to him. Just, hey, if you're going to win the World Series or win a playoff series, period, you're going to have to beat great pitching. That's part of it. They've done it before. They had to take out Corey Kluber last year. They had to beat Clayton Kershaw last year.
Madison Bumgarner
in against the Giants. So that's part of the deal. They're well aware.
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, with a small, who gets the advantage in a 5-game series? Do the Nationals, when you have guys like Max Scherzer who you can throw twice, who you can almost depend on to give you a chance to win, does that favor the Nationals in the fact that they got home field and they've got Max Scherzer?
I think that the Nats are going to be favored in the series, and I do think the fact that you have a bona fide number one going and the Cubs are trying to figure out who exactly is going to pitch game one, you got to give advantage to Nationals. That being said, Cubs rotation is 4 deep and ready to roll, hopefully. I mean, listen, experience-wise, certainly. John Lester's been nails in the playoffs his entire career. He was last year. Jake Arrieta has been a tremendous postseason pitcher. Kyle Hendricks last year pitched phenomenal in Game 7, and I have full confidence in him. And we'll see with Jose Quintana's first trip. The bullpen, you got to love Wade Davis on the back end, but how are you going to get there? So it's, you know, C.J. Edwards is going to have to be better than he was last year. Same thing for Pedro Strop. And Mike Montgomery's going to have a lot of his play.
Justin Wilson, right?
Justin Wilson, he better not be seeing much time. But we'll see.
Well, I wonder, and again, the issue comes down to what you do with that fifth starter, John Lackey. Of course, I mean, not necessarily going to be a guy you're going to go to in that series in Nationals. Can he be a guy who eats up innings, third, fourth, and fifth innings, sixth, seventh inning, that kind of thing?
See, I like Lackey actually on the roster. I don't know if he will be, and he's never pitched out of the bullpen, but he's got that postseason history, man, and he's been big in game sevens in his career. The bullpen right now is weak. I'd rather have an experienced Lackey in there than even a guy like Justin Wilson. You're going to have Dunsing. You're going to have Montgomery. I don't need a third lefty. I'd rather have Lackey.
All right, let's go to Busch Stadium in the locker room, getting doused with champagne. Kevin Powell covering the Cubs at Busch Stadium in St. Louis. Kevin, how's it going? Your eyes stinging?
Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, good. They just started blasting the music. They just sort of had a little team powwow where they're celebrating. They started chanting 11 more. That's obviously 11 more wins to another World Series title. Also, a little bit of news here. John Lester, giving a speech to his teammates, just said that they did a team toast to John Lackey after Lester said this is probably his final regular season start. Lackey, obviously not a huge fan of the media, kind of looked at all of us and said, I'll talk to the boys on the bus, and they kind of just laughed and took a swig of their drinks. But yeah, we'll see here. Maybe we'll get some news in the next few days. Maybe he will announce that this is his final season, because he's sort of been reluctant to fully commit to retirement, hasn't really been willing to share that. But John Lester saying John Lackey probably just pitched his final regular season game, and it was a damn good one from the veteran. That was a huge outing from Lackey.
You know, it's funny, Kevin. John Lackey, for all the flack that he gets here, he's had a good year. The guy's thrown 169 innings, 163 hits. His ERA's 4.5 for a fifth starter. That's perfectly okay. He's won 12 games. He was very good tonight. I think he should be on the playoff roster. That's just me. I'd rather have him as a potential. If Arrieta's hamstring blows out, something along those lines, I'd rather have him there for depth than some of the other options.
Oh, there's no way he's not on the playoff roster. I mean, that's my opinion. Like, especially what I just saw here, the way they rallied around him. I mean, everyone in the clubhouse was just around. I mean, it could be sort of a rallying point for this club. And obviously with that experience, and as you mentioned, Carm, he's had a solid year. And there's some serious question marks with Arrieta, as you just mentioned. He said he had to change his mechanics a little bit yesterday because of that hamstring injury. So who knows what you're going to get there. And John Lester just seems frustrated and upset. So, you know, right now, if you ask me, Kyle Hendricks is your game one starter. He's been the most steady, most reliable guy. He's pitched in it before. So, I don't see Lackey not being on this. I think that would, it just wouldn't sit right to me. Like, right. It's just the sense I'm getting that Lackey will be on the roster. And, yeah, whether, you know, he gets a start or not, he gives you a ton of options there, and he gives you a little bit of a security blanket, as you mentioned, Carm, with Arrieta and Lester, who you thought would be your two rocks in the rotation. But right now, a little bit worrisome, I guess you could say. But, you know, this is obviously huge just to get this thing over with. Now they can rest up. None of them have been shy about the fact that they're really looking forward to a few days of rest, particularly Chris Bryant and Rizzo. And, those guys are going to get a lot of time off here, and that's huge. You know, you didn't want to go to the series finale in St. Louis with all this stress. And, you know, are you going to finish it in St. Louis and have to worry about that? Now they can enjoy themselves, relax, put their feet up for a little bit, and ride this thing out and get healthy and get ready for next Friday in Washington.
Is there an etiquette to this celebration? I mean, is there a time to spray the champagne? Is there a time to talk to the media? Or is it just all happening at the same time and it's chaos?
It's all happening at the same time. You just kind of feel it out and kind of go up to the players when they kind of have a split second. Some of us sort of all flock together. You see a microphone in front of a guy's face. You go towards them right now. A little bottle of Crown Royal being tossed around. They're swigging that. They're swigging beers. They're popping champagne. There's cork littered across the floor of this clubhouse here in St. Louis. And speaking of doing in St. Louis, none of them were denying the fact that this isn't a little bit extra sweet that they did this in St. Louis. The NL Central goes through the Cubs, and this is where the Cardinals were at just a few short seasons ago. So, it's a testament to what the Cubs have done. They built the foundation. It wasn't a one-and-done thing. This is something that's going to last for a long time. And, they all acknowledge that. They were chasing the Cardinals. It's flipped. The Cubs are the team to beat now for this year and probably moving forward here for the next 2-3 years and maybe even longer.
Decade. Why not?
All right, Kevin, get back to it in there and cover your eyes. Kevin Powell at Busch Stadium in the locker room as the Cubs clinch the 2017 NL Central. All right, so we'll take a quick break here, Carm. We'll come back. Let's get a break, and then we can get to Rob's news. We're falling behind, and we'll come back after the news, and we'll continue the conversation about what to expect from the Cubs in that first-round matchup with the Nationals, but also, you know, the other teams on the other side as well, the L.A. Dodgers. There's a lot to talk and a lot to unpack, and we'll also take your calls. David, I see you on the line, 312-981-7200. Stay with us.
Cubs, 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 here come the Cubs. Cubs, 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 here come the Cubs.
All right, the Chicago Cubs clinched the NL Central with a victory over the St. Louis Cardinals, the first time since 1906, 1907, and 1908 that the Cubs have gone back-to-back-to-back in the playoffs.
Is that all?
Is that all? What a tremendous, tremendous season for them as they started in rocky first half, but the second half they've been all ball, all world. The Chicago Cubs right now hot going into the playoffs, and that's where you want to be, Mark Carmen. That's where you want to be.
And that's where they are, baby. The Washington Nationals starting off on the road. So that's, was that Friday, Saturday on the road, probably a day off Sunday, and then Monday at Wrigley Field for Game 3.
Mm-hmm.
Who's not fired up for a Monday at Wrigley, a little Game 3 outside the marquee? Give me an afternoon Monday, maybe. They'll probably be the
doubtful
night game.
It'll be all nighttime. Yeah. Probably Chicago,
the,
yeah.
They back in the day, you'd get an afternoon, or I love an afternoon playoff game. So, I don't know. You split at Washington, come home, take 3 and 4. Let's move along. Let's go, LA. I'm ready.
The Cubs, as we talked about, the rotation. So one area is we talked about right at the beginning of this conversation. We talked about the offense really clicking, all the names who have stepped up, but we didn't mention any pitching, especially starters. Let's talk about this because it's Hendricks, Arrieta, Lester, and Quintana. Where are we at? I mean, who do you like to start? Who do you think is the pitcher to ride in this playoffs? Who's going to be the one who steps up to be the legend of 2017?
Well, reading between the Joe Maddon lines, he was asked recently about who's that number one starter, of course, and he volunteered himself, listening to the tape. You know, Kyle Hendricks has been as hot as anybody. So that guy's in the mix, and I actually think it's going to be Hendricks, because you can't listen. I mean, look at it. John Lester is I think it's actually pretty obvious it's going to be Hendricks. John Lester has not been healthy and is still working his way back, so I'm going to X him off the list. Jake Arrieta has admitted yesterday that, yeah, I've got something in my hamstring that's going to be there,
yeah.
And so he got through 3 innings. You're not going to throw Jose Quintana,
no,
who's never started a playoff game. So I think it's going to be Hendricks in game one.
Okay, well, I would say that...
And that's not an overpowering guy, but...
No, but... And Kyle Hendricks has had a tremendous career at Wrigley Field. And that last year, they kind of... Do you start thinking about the strategy of who pitches where? Obviously, when I think of the...
That's a fair point.
When I think of the Washington Nationals, I think Bryce Harper, left-handed bat. I mean, he might be a switch hitter. Daniel Murphy, switch hitter, but also from the left side. Ryan Zimmerman. I mean, these are guys that they're big hitters on the Washington Nationals are guys that can hit from the left side. So maybe it is a traditional John Lester who comes in to try and steal one in Washington.
Maybe Lester goes game two, and then you've got, I don't know, however they want to do it. They'll probably go lefty-righty, I would think. So I would think you would go Lester on the road and then Quintana at home, probably. Mm-hmm. But who knows?
Who knows?
And the Quintana's never faced the Nationals. So does that work in his favor? Does it work against him? Most times for a pitcher never facing somebody, it works in their advantage. So however Maddon looks at that, as far as him pitching on the road, all that's going on.
All right, let's go to the line. David, you're on. David, you're there. Are you there?
I am here, boys.
All right,
David,
congratulations on your 2017 Cubs.
congratulations to you too.
What would you like to talk about?
I want to talk about just celebrating tonight. I mean, we've come so far. We are the lovable losers, after all. I mean, everyone always putting the Cubs down. We've just come from the depths of despair, and now we've had back-to-back division champions. I don't care who's starting game one. I don't care what's going on in the playoffs. Tonight's a night of celebration. The Chicago Cubs have won back-to-back division championships, and we're going to defend our title.
There you go, David.
What else is there to be said?
Well, you can add on, David, that they won back-to-back titles in 07 and 08, but they didn't win the World Series back then. I mean, you're looking for a back-to-back. You're talking repeat. We're talking Jordan era type of stuff right now on the north side.
We are talking about defending our title, and it's going to be phenomenal. And if you are going to count the Cubs out, I don't care how good the Dodgers have been. I don't care how good the Nats have been. There's no question the competition's a little stronger than last year. No doubt about it. But you cannot count the Chicago Cubs out. We are no longer the lovable losers. Yeah. Theo and Jed have transformed this organization. We are legitimate winners. We're winners.
Love it. David, thank you for the call. That was amazing. Well said. That was a motivational speech. Well, I like that. He's right. We are winners. The Chicago Cubs have is this the moment? Is tonight the night that the Chicago Cubs, I know they won the World Series, so it's hard to say, but the idea of coming back, and it's not a fluke, it's not a one-time thing, is tonight the night that you start to shed permanently this lovable loser myth, this mystique?
Yeah, well, and it, you know, he's speaking to the pain of the Cub fan, and I can speak to the pain of the 40-some-odd-year-old Cub fan. And that started in 84 when you were 11, and they broke your heart up 2 games to none in the Padres, and that's when you realized that life actually wasn't always the greatest thing ever. And then you got to, you know, 89, and they had no chance. I'm going to wipe that off. In 98, they stunk, too, and shouldn't have even been in the playoffs. But then, you know, 03, and up 3-1, and the whole, you know, Alex Gonzalez, I won't mention the rest of it, and never felt more pain in sports ever. And I mean, most Cub fans, or at least I would think a very large portion of the ones that were able to make it to the World Series, thought that they would never see it. Like, that definitely crossed your mind.
Because even when the teams were good, I think about the Pinella years with Derek Lee and Aramis Ramirez. And when they got to the playoffs, for whatever reason, they'd go 0-for-12. Everyone would tighten up and they'd lose in 3 games. That has been the old way of the Cubs. We saw it all the way in every instance you just talked about. Up to now.
Yeah, and up to, I think it's also gets underplayed for whatever reason. The Chicago Cubs were down 3-1 in the World Series, and they came back and won the World Series. That is so anti-Cub. It's the most anti-Cub thing of all time, and they did it. And for a moment there, it looked like they were going to blow it in Game 7, and it would have been the worst loss of all of them, and somehow, some way,
They came through.
All right,
let's go to Dan. Dan, what do you want to say, Dan?
Hey, guys, you couldn't have done it without Nacho Man.
I know, right?
Nacho Man was huge.
No. That's the thing about it. Yeah, that is what you're saying. Thanks, Dan. That's so right. Couldn't do it without Nacho Man. Sick of Nacho Man.
Did you go through his Twitter?
No, I did not go through Nacho Man's Twitter.
I have a little bit too much time on my hand. And I went through Nacho Man's Twitter. He's got things in there like, don't fire the stink bomb in bed. I mean, it's like everything you would think that Nacho Man would say. Nacho Man is one disgusting individual who had a lot of nachos
last night. He had a lot of nachos. All right, so as the Cubs, this will start. I mean, there's still a little bit of time. Obviously, they clinched tonight. They've got was it next week, next Thursday, next Friday they start back?
I mean, Kevin Powell said Friday. I'm going to take him at his word. That's right. But regardless, whenever it is, you know, their wild card game is going to be Wednesday. It'll be Thursday or Friday.
So we got a week to sort out all of this stuff. But, I mean, you mentioned, and also, you know, Dave mentioned this as well. I mean, the Dodgers are there. They've had a historical season and really also the other way, too, losing 10 in a row or 9 of 10 towards the end. Cleveland Indians broke records for their wins. The Houston Astros are essentially the Cubs from last year. There's a lot of competition in this playoff. I mean, this is not as much of a like the Giants last year. You got the feeling they were hanging on. They were trying to get, you know, the Cubs were able to take care of them, a team from yesteryear. But this year, all the competition is going to be pretty fierce.
Cubs were the best team in baseball last year from the start of the season all the way through. Started, 25-6? And, you know, Jason Hayward's speech was about, we've been the best team all year. Let's go out and show it and do it. And don't worry about what's happened so far tonight. We're going to win the game. That hasn't been the case this year. And by the way, Twitter is telling me that I guess the NLDS Game 1 is in D.C. next Friday, so mark it down. But they're not. At least they haven't been. But none of that matters. History tells you, I mean, what, the Mariners won 116, didn't win the World Series. There's a long list of teams who had the best regular season record and didn't win in the playoffs. I wouldn't want to be facing Chris Bryant's on fire right now. Anthony Rizzo's is right there too. Schwarber, I expect him to have a moment in the playoffs too. Javi's been coming up with 2-out, 2-strike base hits in Milwaukee. I mean,
right. I'll ask you the question because seasoned, Addison Russell, a 3-run homer tonight.
Yep.
He's here. He's back. The Cubs put him back at shortstop. They moved Baez to second. You have Schwarber you have to play out in left field. You have Ben Zobrist, who John Madden's not going to put on the bench because of his former, I mean, he was MVP when he was with the Royals. I'm not sure if he, and he had a huge hit in the, or was a huge part of the playoffs last year. I mean, I don't, there's not enough players. I mean, Albert Almora had a great second half in the way that people say he should be the starting center fielder. What do you do here?
It's a great question. Listen, you can't play them all. I don't think Ben Zobrist will start every game. I think that he's, and I mean, how are you, you're not going to take Russell out at short. So that means you're not going to take Javi out of the lineup. So that makes Zobrist an outfielder. He's not going to play every game out there. Now, it's an interesting question to me. Would you sacrifice defense in right field if Jason Heyward starts out the playoffs, say, 0 for his first eight, and you need offense? Would you put a guy like Zobrist in right, and would you play Schwarber in left? I don't think that'll happen. But it might. And the other option, a nuclear option too, you could slide Heyward over to center. You never know.
Yeah, right.
But so then who's leading off? These are all, this is why Joe Maddon makes the big bucks. But I would anticipate that Schwarber will start at least two of the games in the series, and which leaves maybe three for Zobrist. I think those,
I mean,
two are split in left.
He had such a special playoffs 2 years ago. Last year, what a tremendous comeback for the World Series. I mean, this is his time. April, May, not so much. This is his time, right?
No doubt. And the double down the line in Game 7, which put him ahead, and just a quality at bat every time up there, going to see pitches. It's a good problem to have, yeah. But, you know, what are you going to do? And who are you playing in center field? I guess you're playing John Jay and Almora. But, and I also think, you know, you're going to go through a game where, you know, Rizzo's going to start. He'll play the first 5-6 innings. If they're ahead, he's obviously going to be out of the game. So a bunch of guys are going to get in. They're not going to, but they won't be starting games.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about the pitching staff as we, quickly as we wrap up here. But Wade Davis is your bullpen. Last year, what an amazing ride with Aroldis Chapman and a lot of naysayers towards the end where Aroldis Chapman was used in the 6th inning, 7th inning. Do you see that again this year? I mean, do you see when these games get tight and it's a 1-0 game or 2-1 game? Do you go to Wade Davis early, 7th, 8th inning? Or has Joe Maddon learned a little bit of play with fire, going to get burned?
Joe Maddon has most definitely not learned, right? And he put it out there a couple of weeks ago that this is something that Wade knows that we want him to do, and he's ready to do it. And you saw it. It freaked me out, too. On September the 15th, Cubs are up 8-2 on the Cardinals in the first game of the series. And here comes Wade Davis in the 8th inning. And I'm sitting there, what are you doing? Game's over. He shouldn't be pitching perfect. Pitching period. Now, he hadn't thrown for 5 days before the last game he was in was September 10th. But so he throws 1 1/3 there, and then the next day he's in there, and then the next day he's in there.
Stretching him out.
And then
yeah.
The next day they had a day off, and then he was in. He pitched 4 games in a row. And then he got, you know, and then he got hit in Milwaukee, going 1 2/3 and then 1 1/3, he's clearly going to do exactly what he did with Chapman with Davis because he doesn't trust that bullpen. He's going to stretch him out. I mean, that's going to be part of it.
Wow.
That dude's coming in the 8th all playoff long.
I'm more interested in the 7th.
He might.
That's where it gets interesting. Right?
He might.
Yeah. Mark Carman at the Carm on Twitter and with WGN Sports. The Cubs, of course, starting next Friday, and we will continue our coverage of the Cubs here on WGN Radio. Great to talk to you, and, of course, the Chicago Cubs clinching the NL Central. It's good times.
Let's have a month of fun here, Justin. Thanks so much for having me.
Baseball season's underway.
All right, covering the Cubs, clinching the 2017 NL Central, going to the playoffs. Good conversation there with Mark Carman. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, Chicago Bear legend Otis Wilson. He's got a new book, If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Chicago Bears Sideline, Locker Room, and Press Box. We'll talk with Otis Wilson about his career, also about the NFL, and, of course, about race. It's coming up here on The Download, so stay with us.
I'm mama's boy, Otis, one of a kind. The ladies all love me for my body and my mind. I'm slick on the floor as I can be, but ain't no sign to go to get past me. Some guys are jealous of my style and class. That's why some end up on that. I didn't come here looking for trouble. I'm just getting down to the Super Bowl show.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, my next guest at the big table is one of Chicago's most iconic sports figures, Otis Wilson. not only played for the 85 Bears, but the outside linebacker was part of the best trio of linebackers in NFL history, and could be argued that he changed the game forever. Otis Wilson just put out a new book. It's called If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Chicago Bears sideline, locker room, and press box. In the book, Wilson talks Bears football, but also little-known stories like his closed-door blow-ups with Coach Mike Ditka, his relationship with the press, and his thoughts on the league today. The book, co-written by longtime sports writer and broadcaster Chet Kopick. Otis Wilson, my guest tonight at the big table. Mr. Wilson, good to see you again.
Well, thanks for having me at the big table. I certainly appreciate being here, and I'm excited about this book run, and I've been asked about it for the last couple of days, and I just put it like this. I think I had a nice story to tell.
You did.
And I think it was time to tell it because, you know, I've been around a lot of athletes, baseball, basketball, football, and, you know, everybody has, well, not everybody, but most of them has written a book and talked about things. And I said, well, I mean, I'll be 60 Friday, and I think I have one or two stories to tell.
Yeah.
So thanks for having
me. It's a well-known story, the story of your football team. Every time someone gets a chance to document it, it gets documented. But what I like about this is it's your story. It's not necessarily about the 85 Bears. It's about your part of it. And it starts off with you even learning things about your childhood where, as Chet says in the book, if you give you enough time, you'll convince us that you could have played professional basketball.
Well, the God's honest truth, I could have. You know, the only thing different was I might, you know, how the guys gotten taller and taller and taller to be a power forward, you know, but I can use the body pretty good. But, you know, growing up with World Be Free, before that he was Lloyd Free.
Right.
I lived on the first floor. He lived on the fifth floor. So watching him go through, you know, his progression and, you know, 13 years in the NBA, you know, you grow up playing baseball, basketball, and football. And football was – that was me.
Growing up in Brooklyn, you talk about the idea that gangs weren't really for you, drugs weren't really for you. There was this at the time, there was this respect for the jocks. You know, the idea that if you played sports, you were a hero in the area. But you were able to start playing football on asphalt. I play on the grass behind the church, and you're playing on a parking lot.
It was most of the ball fields in New York are blacktopped. You know, so you got a big, huge diamond. You have one on one end, one on the other. In the middle of that, it's nothing but concrete.
Right.
So that's where you learn to play two-hand touch, right there on concrete. And it got to be to a point where it turned into, you know, a little aggressiveness and tackle football. And the guys were saying, oh, if I'm not on your side, I'm not playing. So I think you understand what I'm saying.
Right.
I was knocking the hell out of people.
When did you realize that you had something special as a football player?
Wow, that's a good question because each level from peewee football all the way through high school, people were telling me how good I was. And to mind you again, not having that maturity level as a kid, you know, 13, 14, and 15, you don't pay no mind because I just loved the game. I just wanted to go out there and play. Dick Butkus was my idol. I would draw 51 on my shirts and my mother would get pissed off. She said, I just bought you this brand new shirt. You just marking it all up? I'm like, Ma, I love this guy. You know, so, you know, you just get out there and you just play. And people tell you, you know, you should be over here. And Ralph Scotto, Pioneers program, Pee Wee football, right after my graduating out of junior high, going into high school, I went to Alexander Hamilton because I was still playing basketball.
Right.
So me and Albert King, Bernard King's brother, we were on the same team. We were playing basketball together. You know, so we played in all the leagues, summer leagues, you know, around Brooklyn. And Ralph said, Otis, I think it will serve you best. If you come with me, I got a guy I want you to meet. And that guy was Mo Finkelstein that left the hugest impression on me in my life. Number one, as far as conditioning, working out, and mentally being prepared, this man was doing it way before, you know, because health and fitness was like an education really didn't go together.
Because you talk about it in the book a little later when you talk about your foundation and everything, but you talk about even today kids are eating the wrong things and starting off in an undisciplined way if they want to be athletes. There's something to the fact that before you can even use your God-given talents, you have to be squared up when it comes to your health, your fitness, everything that goes into that discipline.
Well, there's no doubt about it. Your game plan. Like we game plan for a team on Sunday, you have to have a game plan for life. And Mo taught me in high school, my freshman year, because I transferred out of Alexander Hamilton, listened to Ralph, went over there, and I watch this man eat. I watch this man exercise. I watch this man run every day, and it just got ingrained in me. And you know, and he focused on education because he was a gym teacher. So he said, if you miss a class, I'm putting y'all on the table. He had what they call a table, and he had one of those frat paddles, and he would beat you like he would, you were his chair. And
for missing a class.
And then for missing a class. And finally, we got it. We understood what he was really talking about.
Do you think that discipline, the idea of even in early days of high school and even into high school, into college, do you think that helps you as a professional ball player, not just and how you address your physical fitness, but I mean being able to deal with coaches, being able to deal with the rigors of you better be at this meeting at the right time, at the right place, the idea that it's more military than it is fun?
I think it's more discipline because there's a right way to do something and there's a wrong way. If you're going to go into a meeting and you're trying to close a million-dollar deal, you can't get there 2 minutes before that deal. You have to do your homework the night before, get there 15 minutes, because you never know what's going to happen. You might get a flat tire. You might get whatever. People say I'm too black and white, you know, especially my wife. She said, you're black and white. I said, no, I'm disciplined. I understand regiments, and it's been ingrained in me. And, you know, you follow your game plan. Now, sometimes that game plan might not always work, but when you take care of yourself, when you educate yourself, when you handle your business will handle you.
I really want to talk about, you know, coming to Chicago, getting a chance to play for the Chicago Bears and Buddy Ryan. Even those passages in the book are all measured around this idea of discipline, this idea of what it means to play for a coach, but also to understand the coach. It took a while for you to understand what Buddy Ryan wanted of you and the players. But there's a lot that goes in around that idea of being prepared.
I found out early what a good coach was because Mo, not only will he instill those disciplines in you, he taught you how to be a good person. You know, have values, have respect. You know, this is how you live. People want to deal with you when you're following the right thing. You know, so when you combine all that, you know, you understand what good coaching. And then when I got with Buddy, I mean, I didn't like him at first.
Let's do this. Let's take a break, and we'll pick up right away with Buddy Ryan. Otis Wilson in studio. His new book is If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Chicago Bears Sideline, Locker Room, and Press Box. He wrote it with Chet Kopic. Of course, we'll take a quick break here. We'll come back more with Otis Wilson at the big table. Stay with us.
They're the monsters of the Midwest, rolling across the USA.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio tonight at the big table, Otis Wilson, the all-world linebacker on the All-Madden Century team, pretty impressive. But to Chicagoans, just a Chicago Sports Hall of Famer, linebacker for the Chicago Bears, of course, the 85 Bears. He wrote a new book called If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Chicago Bears Sideline, Locker Room, and Press Box, out now, co-authored with Chet Kopic. Let's talk about you coming to Chicago. I thought it was fascinating to read about you being a rookie, coming in, getting to play with Doug Plank, we have on the show all the time, lining up next to Alan Page and others. There was a lot before Otis Wilson was Otis Wilson. You were a rookie, Otis Wilson.
I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. You know, growing back up in Brownsville, idolizing Dick Butkus, then come find out, because I honestly thought I was going to play out in L.A. somewhere, you know, whether it was San Francisco or the Raiders, because those were the team that was real hard on the radar. But to get that call from George Halas, which was a great individual, knew everything about me, I'm like, whoa, how'd you get that information? And, you know, being here, I said, wow, Monsters of the Midway. This fits me very, very well.
What did you know of the Bears coming in?
Dick Butkus. That was it. I'm just him taking people's heads off and Monsters of the Midway and the Black and Blue Division. So I knew I had to bring it to the table. I was excited. I was ready for the challenge. And Lord knows that I get stopped cold in my tracks with Buddy Ryan. I mean, number one, this man never called me by my name. 55, 96, 76. The only person that had a name was Walter Payton. He said, don't you hit Walter Payton. Don't mess up our team because that's all we got. And mind you, in high school and college, you had a simplified defense, you know, so basically set up for a middle linebacker like myself to make all the tackles. Here you come in here with Buddy, You got to be in the thinking man's game.
You came in as a middle linebacker. You're known. You had the football IQ to call plays and get the defense in its position. But when you come to Chicago, you make your name as an outside linebacker, as somebody who moves over and becomes, as called in the book, an assassin. You know, you are. That's your job to rush the quarterback and use your speed and versatility to change the game. Talk about that. Was that an easy transition for you to do?
Well, I think it was made for me because, number one, you know, when you see this 34 defenses they run in today and the 46 stand out on that outside, I mean, God, I love to compete. I mean, I don't think that any tackle in this league in my prime can keep up with me. So that was exciting. But coming from, you know, the middle linebacker, which Singletary held that down,
yeah. And
learning what I had to learn with him, it was quite difficult, but I said to myself, I said, the only way you're going to comprehend this after him beating you down, because he beats you down,
Buddy Ryan does,
to build you back up.
Yeah.
And I realized that after a while. So Buddy and I would just sit and watch film. He'll have his little pipe, smoking his little pipe, rocking back and sipping on his little Jameson or Duro's White Label. And, you know, we would talk, you know, about life and about the game plan, and then the light came on. I totally understood what he was trying to do, what he was trying to get me to do, and how he wanted everybody to play together.
You heard that in the 30 for 30 special. You hear other players who are interviewed talk about almost the identical way of, at one point, the light bulb goes on, and you recognize that this is a team game, and Buddy Ryan is put us all in a position to win. It's amazing to think about a pretty quiet or soft-spoken coach to the media, to the fans. Mm-hmm. Didn't know much about the guy. He's on the sideline, a kind of gruff guy who we loved the results, of course. But he was the opposite of Mike Dickey. He was the opposite of most coaches who go and talk in front of the media. So it's great for us, you know, after his death to understand who he is. But as fans, we never really got this who Buddy Ryan was behind the scenes.
You're right in saying that. You know, Buddy wasn't the kind of guy that he felt he needed to get all the publicity and that you need to draw attention to him. He deflected a lot of stuff when it came to Dicker, you know, and the players. He said, these are my guys.
Right.
Let me deal with my guys. You go over there and you deal with them. I will stand up for them. You know, very soft-spoken, don't say a lot of words. You know, but he tell you his feelings. Because sometimes it's like your dad. He'd look at you a certain way, and you know it's like, okay, let me fall in line, you know. So.
Well, you can't argue with the results. You know, as a football player, even at the college level and playing later with the Raiders, talk about what makes a great defensive coordinator. I feel like I understand the game. I watch the game. We always hear there's game plans and what they have to do to counter the offense. But what, in your mind, is a guy who played at a Pro Bowl, all-pro level, what makes a great defensive coordinator?
Dan Hampton, Richard Dent, Wilbur Marshall,
right, right.
Otis Wilson,
right.
Mike Singletary, Fridge, Steve McMichael, Gary Fenson,
yeah.
Doug Plank, Les Frazier,
yep.
Mike Richardson. We had the players that were number one, that were committed people, that understood the game, that to articulate the game, and went out there and played the game. I mean, we got to where we were competing against ourselves
right. Every
day. We made ourselves better because I looked over there down that line and I saw Richard. I'm like, look like Richard's going to get that guy. I'm going to get over there first. Whatever it took, I'm going to make sure I get there first.
There was competition.
It's always competition, even in practice.
Even in practice.
I mean, and that's what really makes a good offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator. It's not those X's and O's.
I mean, players. They
understand – you know, how to put you in that position, but they got to get you to understand, number one, how to play together, how to stay humble, and be in unison. So
there's a story in the book, and there's a lot of great stories in the book. Otis Wilson, my guest at the big table, his new book is out, about a certain game in the 84 season against the Oakland Raiders. And this was a game in which it really was the moment in which you guys, the way you tell it and the way it's told by Chet, you and Chet, it's this idea that you come into your own. The Oakland Raiders were the world champs at that point. Their defensive unit was not resting when you guys were on the field. They were up on the sideline watching you because this is the first anyone had seen in the 46 defense. This is the first anyone had understood what was happening with you and Wilbur Marshall on the other side. Talk about that game because that is the game that was almost the homecoming, if you will, or the coming out party for the Chicago Bears defense.
Well, to set that whole stage, anytime you play against a world championship club, you have to put your chin strap on because they're going to knock your block off if you let them. And we have something to prove because everybody know the Raiders' mistake. You know, the black crossbones and skulls. They just going to take you out.
They and were the defensive team. They exactly. were the ones with the stars,
they,
right?
They're the king of the hill.
Right.
To be the king of the hill, you got to knock off the champ. And we sat in the locker room. Number one, we didn't say nothing. Nobody said anything to anybody. I looked at Wilbur because my locker was Wilbur and I, our locker roommates, and locker was right next to each other. I'm like, Wilbur, there's just something funny about today. Nobody was like saying nothing. Normally, you hear a little laugh here, you hear some music, you know, to relax you, but it was a little calm, and I figured that's the calm before the storm. And when we went out there, we had something to prove. You know, and what I like about it most is I see Marcus Allen all the time. I play golf with him, and he said, you know, Otis, when we game plan against people, it was always, you know, we got to know where one person is. He said, we had a hell of a time trying to figure out where Richard was, where you was, where Singletary was. He said, we didn't know who to defend against. Mark Wilson, his head was on a swivel because I think we put him out. Ray Guy was the second backup.
Yeah, he didn't want to come in.
He didn't want to come in. He went in, literally went in the locker room, told Mark Wilson, you better get back out of here because I'm not going out there playing quarterback. And Marcus Allen told me this story. I mean, we beat them so physically bad.
It was a violent game. It was two big teams, but it was the introduction to the Bears 46.
You know, Lyle Alzado, after the game, because, you know, he's from Far Rockaway in Brooklyn, and he came to me and said, yo, Brooklyn, he said, y'all got the reins. He said, I've never seen a defense play like that before in my life. I got to hand it to you. You got it.
Chills. As a Chicago Bears fan, I mean, you can go all the way back and you could talk about Buckus and you could talk about all the other great defensive teams that this franchise has put on the field. But when you think about that squad in 84 and 85 and beyond, it's those games and those moments where I'm in the NFL history, you don't hear too many stories where quarterbacks say, I don't want to go out there. I think that's what, when you try to find the mystique of why this is this Bears, the fan base loves defense. Yeah. It's stories like that.
Well, and the one thing that I can't remember if I put it in the book or not, but Singletary watched so much film. He would sometimes just call out plays right here, right there, right there. They running right there. We seen quarterbacks eyes get biggest quarters, and like, I mean, literally silence. He don't know what to do. He just called a timeout
because he knows
they's coming right there. And Singletary called his stuff out.
Wow.
You know, so they got. It was like, what do we do with this? I mean, we were just having fun. Right.
Otis Wilson, my guest tonight here on the Big Table. He's the author of If These Walls Could Talk: Stories from the Chicago Bears Sideline, Locker Room, and Press Box. He wrote it with Chet Kopic. Plus the All-Pro linebacker in studio tonight. We'll get a break for the news. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation at the Big Table with Otis Wilson, 55. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Otis Wilson, girl number 55. He's got a book out called If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Chicago Bears Sideline, Locker Room, and Press Box. He wrote it with Chet Kopic. He's in studio tonight. And like I said, right when we started this interview, the idea that this story's been told, the 85 Bears, we know it. We've seen so much media on the Chicago Bears. But what I find interesting is that when you guys became celebrities, past the Super Bowl shuffle and the idea the next year, everybody won, that you still had to be a football team. There's stories about Dicka saying you can't do commercials. You know, or Jim McMahon's the only one doing commercials. But more important, people stepping up and almost like personalities becoming larger than life. Take us to that moment after the Super Bowl, because we know all about the Super Bowl. The year after, that famed year that we've heard so much about that we could have won five more championships.
Well, number one, I think we would have won at least two in a row, possibly three, if Buddy would have stayed. Because when Buddy left, the system left. So therefore, we had to figure out what Vince Tobin was trying to do, and as far as Vince Tobin, you know, a lot of the guys didn't have a lot of respect for him because Dicker kind of ruled over him, and
right.
We used to our coach backing us, and we had no backing, you know. And Willie Gault, he left to the Raiders that year, so that deep threat was gone, you know, the system with the defensive system was gone. So, but mind you,
we still wasn't too bad
because we got pride. We saw losers, so we're going to, you know, keep it up. But you can't compare one system to the other. You know, so that is a big, big factor.
Beyond the X's and O's and on the field, as there was so much scrutiny / attention to the team, what was that like in the locker room? What was it like that everyone was now a star? Everyone was had a Coke commercial. Everybody was on the front page of something. You guys were the all-star of all-stars when it comes to a football team.
And that was actually the great thing about it, because if you had one or two guys getting all the meat and potatoes, you know, you probably have some animosity. You know, we knew Walter, Jim McMahon, and Fridge was Park Avenue. Everybody else was doing stuff locally, you know, car dealers, commercials, posters, you know, so it was enough to share in there for everybody. Because Dick has said when we first got here, when he was campaigning to get his new job, life in football is just a short period of time in your life. Take advantage of all those opportunities, you know, because you never know how long you're going to play. So we got that part coming from a former player, and then we start having our success, and we saw all that coming, you know, so, and it started happening, but we knew how to handle it, you know, mentally. It didn't distract from football. We were still winning football games, although we were doing the Super Bowl shuffles, or we were doing, you know, whatever we were doing. We were still taking care of business. And then it got to a point where, you know, Dickens just shut all that down. He said, you know, I'm going to run everything through my office. I don't want y'all doing all this stuff. 2 weeks later, he on every TV station, every channel. He's selling everything. I'm like, God almighty.
Right?
But mind you, he didn't mess with Walter's, Fridge, or McMahon stuff because
he couldn't.
He couldn't. So he just cut all of us little guys out.
This is a great segue into a real big part of this book, a part that people are talking about, is your relationship with Coach Dicka. A lot of animosity. There in that season, a blow up towards the end when you were hurt and you wanted to come back in the field, and he said, we're okay with where we're at. He kind of viewed you as a Buddy Ryan guy, disciple, and that, of course, as we know from history, there was a friction between the two of them. What was your relationship like with Coach Dicka?
Well, let me say this. I have great respect for Coach Dicka, and I think if you talk to him, he's going to tell you he respects me, because I was always taught you give respect and you get respect. And it's always an unspoken rule in football. You do not lose your job due to injury. You know, once that you're able to come back out there and perform, you get back out there. When, in fact, he told me, well, I like the way it is with Ron Rivera. I said, well, okay, cool.
Well, you didn't say no.
Let me tell you something. When I'm healthy, can't nobody do what I can do. I don't care who you put out there. I'm the best at what I do. You know, that's when the friction started. He said, well, you're not going to play. I said, well, let me tell you something. I can either play here and I can play with somewhere else. Then one word went to the next word, then one word to the next word. Then he said, well, you know, I'll just go ahead and blackball you. I said, let me tell you something. You ain't going to take my livelihood away from me, because I will take you out. You know, I grew up in a neighborhood where, you know, I taught Mike Tyson how to be tough. You know, so that ain't happening.
I think that says volumes where, you know, you being one of the superstars of the defense and the coach who's the superstar coach of the team are, you know, going to blows in the office over whether or not you're going to be on the field. That says a lot about your relationship with Coach Dicka.
Well, I think when you talk to him now, he'll tell you it's a lot of things I've done I would do a lot differently. You know, you guys were the best at what you did. But back then, his thing was, it's my way or the highway.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm like, cool. But if you want me to take the highway, cool, I'm going to take the highway. But you're not going to just, you know, tell me to do some BS.
Coach Dicka shows up at the end of the book as well, when you're with a chapter about Colin Kaepernick and the idea that, you know, he's on the other side. He's a guy who thinks that Kaepernick should stand up for the anthem. He has had some choice words in the media. He'll make his mind known. You, on the other hand, have been a supporter of Colin Kaepernick and the idea of being able to protest the anthem. Talk about that, because you have some choice words, again, about Mike Dicka and the way that he presents himself politically.
Well, let me just say this. Everybody has their political view. My thing is, it's not about the national anthem, and they're trying to make it about the national anthem. This is about injustice to black men in America. You being profiled, you sit in the car, you can get killed. Just look what just happened in Las Vegas. You know, somebody supposedly shot a gun off in a casino. First person they grabbed was a black man, you know, and throw him on the ground and put a gun to his head.
Right.
You know, so to tell people you're un-American, you know, it's stupid. You know, we all have a right to protest, the freedom of speech, and to stand up for what you stand up for. You know, so don't turn one thing into another thing. This ain't about the flag. This is about injustice in the black community. You know, it just so happens the stage he has is a huge stage, you know, the NFL football. So, you know, now a lot of the guys are starting to take some kind of legs. Now, I don't know where that will go or what it's going to do.
Mike Dicka kind of falls into that category, which you talk about, the NFL logo. You mentioned in this book about the hypocrisy of the league and this idea that the NFL is will do whatever it does to make money. It doesn't necessarily care about the players or race in this country or anything of that nature. So there is something to be said about an NFL, a league that brought you success, is a league that's changed. In your words and in the book, has moved into something else.
It was totally different from when I played. I mean, we was always told that we are the fabric of what the NFL is all about. We built this, but yet they don't want to compensate us. You know, when guys, you know, injuries or guys is financially, physically destitute or, you know, have brain issues or whatever, when it come down to that, where are they? You know, so do you really care about us or are you just saying that to put more money in your pocket? So I differ. You know, I understand anybody making money. You should make money. If you're in business to make money, you should prosper. But the man that you ride in his back, you should reciprocate. Mm-hmm. And they don't do that.
Social justice and issues of politics usually wouldn't cross over onto the football field. And we're seeing in 2017 a different world that we live in, where the NFL is almost a mirror of the society we live in. Do you think that's a good thing? Do you think that the NFL should take on this scrutiny when it comes to issues of politics or social justice?
Well, you're right. With social media, the times today is totally different, you know, from the 80s.
Right.
You know, and you have to view things differently, and you have to conform with it because that's reality. These kids today could be sitting in the room with us talking, but they're on the phone talking to each other. They ain't verbally communicating with one another right away. They're on the phone. They're on social media. Because my son coaches at West Virginia State. You know, and I asked him, how do y'all do the recruiting? He said, we followed him on Facebook. What happened to the coach taking a ride down to New York or Brooklyn
right.
and then sitting in your parents' living room and tell you how good the university is going to be to your child? It is what it is. I mean, so you have to handle things differently. The platform is going to be different. The cause is going to be different. But the bottom line is, you know, you have to be careful when you do it and how you, what platform you pick. So that's a hard one.
It's just interesting to me because there's been this year you've heard more and more writers talk about boycotting the NFL because of the issues. And you mentioned in the book, and you're very straightforward when it comes to what's happening, even in the city, when we talk about violence and other things. It's just interesting to me because you, whether you like it or not, are a hero. And you're a football player who played on the 85 Bears. And I think everybody, myself, Pete, everybody who'd be listening to this right now, we have nothing but it's unbelievable what a Super Bowl a winning team will do.
Exactly.
But do you see any sort of responsibility as Otis Wilson to bring some of these issues of inequality or race issues to light? Do you find in this book a responsibility to talk about these things?
Well, I do and I don't. You know, and I'll start with I do. You know, the system has been good to me. And I owe it to my community and the people that live in my community to go back and help them. You know, and try to make them better. And that's why I started the Otis Wilson Foundation.
Right,
you know,
right.
And I work with young people, you know, Chicago Public School kids, an after school program. And, you know, it's 5 days a week. And I try to, you know, get them, you know, in a safe haven place where they're not out on the streets doing the devil's playground work, you know, doing something positive, you know, reading books, educating yourself, playing, doing healthy things. But on the other hand, like we all say in the neighborhood, you're going to have some hard heads. But you know who they are, so you know where they are. And I can't take certain platforms or every platform that I have, you know, vocalize that. You know, I think I'm visible enough, honored enough to where TV and radio will sometimes sit down and talk to me that I can talk about it at that particular time.
Right.
And keep the word out there. Because some stages, people don't want politics or religion, you know, thrown in their face.
Yeah.
So that's why I say it's a balancing act that, you know, you just can't do it all the time.
You, like you said, turning 60 years old. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
For you to be 60 years old, for Otis Wilson to be 60, that ages all of us.
Yeah.
I mean, 'cause we saw you as a vision of youthful athleticism on the field and winning championships and overcoming adversity. What's it mean to you to look back on those days, to be 60 years old and to look back on your time playing football for the Chicago Bears?
Well, you know, I got to say, I'm in the third quarter of my life. When getting ready for the fourth quarter, you got to make it count. You know, you got to put your foot down and really make it count. I mean, find out. Well, ain't no find out. I know exactly what I want to do with my life. I know where I want to go. Do the things that I enjoy. You know, I have two grandkids. I have a 13-year-old, a grandson, and a 5-year-old granddaughter. You know, I love playing golf. I love traveling. Get those things in because we always talk about the past. We live in the present. And the future is not promised to you. So I'm going to Dubai in December, and I'm going to stay there for a while. And my wife and I, we're just going to have a great time. So 60 for me is going to be the best time of my life because I feel good. I'm fit. I just want to do things and have fun, you know, and really give back because that's never going to change. I mean, there's always going to be folks out there that needs help, you know, because you look at, you know, Houston, you look at Florida. I mean, people think they have their life together. Now they got to start all over again. Yeah. I mean, with just simple, basic things that we take for granted. I mean, where am I going to live? What am I going to wear tomorrow? I mean, everything is gone. So you never know what's going to happen. I know we ain't going to get a hurricane here, but...
Yeah, we'll get something else, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Otis Wilson, the all-pro Chicago Bears linebacker who changed the game. His book, If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Chicago Bears Sideline, Locker Room, and Press Box. He wrote the book with Chet Copping. A pleasure as always, Otis Wilson. Thanks so much for being my guest tonight at the big table.
Well, thank you for having me at the table, and this was a great time. I mean, you know, the questions you asked, I mean, just bring back a wealth of information. I see a big old smile on my face because – when I think about that team, when I think about Chicago, people all over the world talk about Chicago. I could be in Tokyo, and they say, hey, Otis! And they want to know about the 85 Super Bowl team.
Absolutely.
So, you know, and Walter Payton, what kind of guy was he? So I hope people enjoy this book. There's a lot of great stories in it, and it's from the heart, and because that's who I am. I'm going to tell you like it is. I ain't going to pull no punches.
I love it. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, coming up, Brian Noonan's in for Patty Vasquez tonight. Good to see Brian as he comes in pretty soon here. What a night for news, for breaking news. The Cubs, of course, clinching the NL Central tonight. Hugh Hefner dies at the age of 91. Big stories happening in Chicago tonight. Rob will have all that stuff coming up in the news here. I can't wait to delve into the history of Playboy. I was never a big fan of Playboy and the company and everything that goes into it. But I do understand the importance the company has to Chicago, whether it's the, you know, it's humble beginnings here and the Playboy Club and the Playboy Building and all of the business that was done here in Chicago. It's a lot of the city's history. The magazine, you know, and I know people say, oh, you read them for the article.
I saw somebody tweet saying that he's going to miss Hugh Hefner for the articles, which I thought was a funny tweet.
I don't have a fascination, and I know a lot of people do, but I don't have a fascination about the Playboy Mansion or his life or the idea of being the bachelor and the sexuality and frankly, the sexism around it. It's a part that I haven't I never found any fascination in that, but I am fascinated by Chicago and the connection to Chicago. If you've been to the old Playboy Club and the Playboy Building on over here in the Gold Coast, you know, it predates me, but there have been remnants and pop-up type stuff, and I always thought that was fun. So Hugh Hefner dead at the age of 91 tonight. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. Brian Noonan will take over. Stay with us.